changes all around, and people everywhere have seen the light in what they've found. It's a happy place in the human race, when all our lives are lived for giving. When love is what you find, despair and loneliness, you've got to leave them far behind. Tell the clouds to go, let the feeling show. It's great when your life is full of living.
To me, I can see and know mankind.
feeling's got to stay till all the world is living, till all the world is giving, till all the world is loving every day.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, July 15, 2019. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389-pound. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on the donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading, we're going to pick up where we left off last week in the Gospel of John. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. We're in chapter 21. We had left off at verse 14. We're going to pick up from verse 15 through 25, which will bring us to the end of the Gospel of John, and next week we'll pick up somewhere else. Okay, John chapter 21, verse 15. So when they had dined, Jesus said unto Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, lovest thou me more than these? He said unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my lambs. He saith to him again, and the second time, Simon, son of Jonah, lovest thou me? He saith unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my sheep. He saith unto him a third time, Simon, son of Jonah, lovest thou me? Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, Lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. Jesus saith unto him, Feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself, and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thine hands. Another shall gird thee, and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. This spoke he, signifying by what death he should glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he saith unto him, Follow me. Then Peter, turning about, seeth the disciples, whom Jesus loved, following, which also leaned on his breast at supper, and said, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee? Peter, seeing him, saith to Jesus, Lord, and what shall this man do? Jesus saith unto him, Will that he tarry till I come? What is that to thee? Follow thou me. Then went this saying abroad among the brethren, that that disciple should not die yet. Jesus said not unto him, He shall not die. But if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? This is the disciple which testifieth of these things, and wrote these things, and we know that this testimony is true. And there also are many other things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written, every one, suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. Amen. End of the Gospel of John. That was chapter 21. We had read through verses 15 through 25. And again, next week we'll pick up in another one of the books in the Bible. Okay, tonight's subject is going to be focusing in on the tax courts. I'm going to try this shouldn't take, well, probably less than 20 minutes to go through this. I'm going to try to shorten down the time period I take in, on a particular subject. It'll give us more time on the other end of things to have some open forum time. I know last week were quite long, but this week should be under 20 minutes, and maybe we'll have some discussions on the subject, hopefully, or we can discuss some of the other topics that we've been talking about over the months. So let me start off. Let's see. On tax courts. The purpose of this memorandum is to reveal the lawless operation of tax courts in our federal district court buildings, presided over by federal district court judges. Taxpayers have been bullied and threatened, especially small taxpayers and those without legal assistance. There is no authority for the judiciary of the United States District Courts to claim any legislative authority to create U.S. tax courts called an Article I court. Such courts are a de facto courts. Any tax upon a person or their property is tantamount to a slave tax, whereas the taxer becomes the sovereign. Any such tax is called a direct tax, which is absolutely forbidden by Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, which reads, "No captation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration thereof before directed to be taken." Judicial abuse and fraud. United States Supreme Court. Congress cannot, by any definition of income it may adopt, conclude the matter, since it cannot by legislation alter the Constitution, from which alone it derives its power to legislate, and within those limitations alone that power can be lawfully expressed. The 16th Amendment does not justify the taxation of persons or things previously immune. It was intended only to remove all occasions for any apportionment of income taxes among the states. It does not authorize a tax on a salary. In construing federal revenue statutes, the Supreme Court gives no weight to Treasury regulations which attempt to add to statutes something which is not there. Treasury regulations can add nothing to income as defined by Congress. 16th American Jurisprudence, 2nd edition, section 177. The general misconception is that any statute passed by legislators bearing the appearance of law constitutes the law of the land. The U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and any statute to be valid must be in agreement. It is impossible for both the Constitution and a law violating it to be both valid. One must prevail. This is succinctly stated as follows. The general rule is that an unconstitutional statute, though having the form and name of law, is in reality no law, but is wholly void and ineffective for any purpose, since unconstitutionality dates from the time of its enactment, and not merely from the date of the decision so branding it. As unconstitutional law in legal contemplation is an operative as it had never been passed, such a statute leaves the question that it purports to settle just as it would be had the statute not been enacted. Since an unconstitutional law is void, the general principle follows that it imposes no duties, confers no rights, creates no office, bestows no power or authority on anyone. It affords no protection and justifies no acts performed under it. A void act cannot be legally consistent with a valid one. An unconstitutional law cannot operate to supersede any existing valid law. Indeed, insofar as a statute runs counter to the fundamental law of the land, it is superseded thereby. No one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it. Any court, government, or government officer who acts in violation of, in opposition, or contradiction to the foregoing, by his or her own action commits treason and invokes the self-executing Section 3 and 4 of the 14th Amendment and vacates his or her office. It is the duty of every lawful American citizen to oppose all enemies of this nation, foreign and domestic. U.S. Title 26 is not law. USC 267806B established that Title 26 USC is not to infer, imply, or presume to be law, and therefore cannot have any legal effect because there exists no intent in law, and thereby the court cannot conclude presumption in law in its groupings or any particular section or provision or portion of USC Title 26. 26 U.S.C. 7806B. No implication or presumption of legislative construction shall be drawn or made by reason of the location or grouping of any particular section or provision or portion of this title, nor shall any table of contents, table of cross-references, or similar outline, analysis, or descriptive matter relating to the contents of this title be given any legal effect. The preceding sentence also applies to the side notes and ancillary tables contained in the various prints of this act before its enactment into law, which never occurred, nor could it by law occur. The Reform Act of 1986 renamed the code as IRS Code of 1986, but did not make comprehensive changes to it. There are no historical or revision notes, and amendment notes only go back to 1954, as if it were positive law title. Although Title 26 has not been enacted, the Internal Revenue has been and is laid out exactly like Title 26. The said Act of 1939 does not claim to be enacted into law. USC Title 26 IRC was never codified and thereby never enacted into positive law, nor can it be because it has no constitutional authority. The fictitious U.S. tax courts that the federal judiciary falsely claims to be an Article I court are at best a nisi prius court with no constitutional authority. As stated above, Congress in 26 U.S.C. 7806B established that Title 26 U.S.C. is not law, and therefore there is no authority for the United States District Courts to presume any legislative construction, which means law, that can establish a tax court under 26 U.S.C. 7441. Furthermore, tax courts are de facto statutory courts that claim to be a court of record, which is to proceed according to the course of the common law, also known as natural law and not statutes. The United States Supreme Court said that the judgment of a court of record whose jurisdiction is final is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. It is as conclusive on this court as it is in other courts. It puts an end to the inquiry concerning the facts by deciding it. The IRS, being a corporation, fraudulently claimed to be the sovereign of the tax court under 26 U.S.C. 7441 status, thereby decreeing unnatural law in a de facto court of record, as they claim to be king over the people, as if the people are subjects. This is an abomination. It is the people that are the sovereign. Agents of the IRS are employees of a fictional corporation with no natural rights. There cannot be any statute or constitutional authority that would allow a de facto statutory court to take control of a sovereign. There is no authority for the judiciary of the United States District Courts to claim any legislative authority to create U.S. tax courts called an Article I court. In Article III, the people vested the Supreme Court and its inferior court's judicial power in all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, whereas Congress was empowered to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, as described in Article III. The Constitution is completely silent concerning the creation of a tax court ruled over by a sovereign corporation, which is an oxymoron, and therefore Congress can make no law concerning the same. The United States Constitution Article 3, Section 2. The judicial powers shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and the treaties made or which shall be made under their authority, to all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdictions, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, to controversies between two or more states, between a state and a citizen of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants, if different states, and between a state or the citizen thereof, and foreign states, citizens, or subjects. Subsequently, there are no laws arising under the Constitution, nor can there be, for the creation of an Article I tax court. Such a creation is unlawful and thereby null and void. Tax courts lack personam jurisdiction over the people, and the judiciary is bound thereby the supreme law of the land to cease and desist placating such an abomination. Article 4. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. The United States Supreme Court decisions concerning tax courts. When one of the people inquire of their government servants information concerning the law with an intent to obey the law, the servant that had been empowered to exercise that law have a legal and moral duty to speak. Silence can only be equated with fraud where there is a legal or moral duty to speak, or where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading. U.S. versus Thiel and U.S. versus Putin and Carmine versus Bowen. No judicial process, whatsoever form it may assume, can have any lawful authority outside of the limits of the jurisdictions of the court or judges by whom it is issued, and any attempt to enforce it beyond these boundaries is nothing less than lawless violence. Illegitimate and unconstitutional practices get their first footing by silent approaches and slight deviations from legal modes of procedure. This can only be obviated by adhering to the rule that constitutional provisions for the security of persons and property should be liberally construed. A close and literal construction deprives them of half their efficacy and leads to gradual depreciation of the rights, as if it consisted more in sound than in substance. It is the duty of the courts to be watchful for the constitutional rights of the citizens and against any stealthy encroachments thereon. Their motto should be Obsta Principis, Boyd versus United States. The requirement of an offense committed willfully is not met. Therefore, if a taxpayer has relied in good faith upon prior decisions of this court, U.S. versus Bishop and Abelman versus Booth, only the rare taxpayer would be likely to know that he could refuse to produce his records to Internal Revenue agents, who would believe the ironic truth that cooperative taxpayers fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights. United Station versus Dixon. The legal right of a taxpayer decreases the amount of what otherwise would be his taxes, or altogether avoid them by means within the law permits, cannot be doubted. Gregory versus Helvering. The individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. He is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. He has no duty to the state or to his neighbor to divulge his business or to open his doors to an investigation so far as it may tend to incriminate him. He owes no such duty to the state, since he receives nothing therefrom beyond the protection of this life and property. His rights are such as existed by the law of the land long antecedent to the organization of the state and in accordance with the Constitution. Among his rights are a refusal to incriminate himself and the immunity of himself and his property from arrest or seizure except under a warrant of law. He owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon their rights. An individual may lawfully refuse to answer incriminating questions unless protected by immunity statute. Hale versus Hinkle. To penalize the failure to give a statement which is self-incriminatory is beyond the power of Congress. U.S. versus Lombardo. Privilege against self-incrimination is in part individual substantive right to private conclave where he may lead in private life. Constitutional foundation underlying privilege against self-incrimination is the respect of the government, state, or federal must accord to dignity and integrity of its citizens. Fifth Amendment provisions that individuals cannot be compelled to be witness against themselves cannot be abridged. Miranda versus the State of Arizona. That statute which would deprive the citizens of rights of persons of property without the regular trial according to the course and usage of common law would not be the law of the land. Hoke versus Henderson. This willful qualification fully protects one whose refusal is made in good faith and upon grounds which entitle him to the judgment of the court before obedience is compelled. Federal Power Commission versus Metropolitan Edison Company. The claim and exercise of a constitutional right cannot be converted into a crime. Miller versus United States. Once warnings have been given, if individuals indicate in any manner, at any time, prior to or during questioning, that he wishes to remain silent, interrogations must cease. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Ernesto Miranda versus State of Arizona. There can be no sanction or penalty imposed upon one because of his exercise of constitutional right. Scherer versus Cullen. The constitutional privileges was intended to shield the guilty and imprudent, as well as the innocent and foresighted. Marchetti versus the United States. The privilege is not limited to testimony as ordinarily understood, but extends to every means by which one may compel to produce information which may incriminate. Boyd versus the United States. In conclusion, said tax courts have no constitutional authority, can provide no due process, have no basis in law, have no jurisdiction over the people, and therefore must cease and desist all their unlawful actions against the people. Sealed and dated and signed, Grand Jury Foreman. Okay. I should have mentioned earlier before we started reading here, I forgot that this memorandum is available up on the website. Anybody who wants to get a copy of that, all they have to do is go to nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight the grand jury, and come down just one box and click on Action Against the Judiciary. And a lot of papers you'll find there that we've already filed and served on to our servant government at every level, on the federal and state level. And we are still preparing to file our case against the judiciary and the Congress, both houses. Been working on that quite a bit. It's starting to really come to form. And hopefully in the next couple of weeks we'll be able to file this paper. I know we were hoping to do it last month. We just haven't been able to really get the job done yet. There's a lot of work in this particular paper, and we want to get everything as perfected as possible. But also timing is important. I don't think 2 weeks ago would be the right timing. So as soon as it gets done, Lord willing, the timing will be good. And if we decide to retard it a little bit because we feel that the timing isn't right, then we'll do so. But I think things are getting real ripe at this point. I think timing is coming really, really close, and so we are kind of stepping up the speed of trying to get this paper done. But we don't want to move too quick that we become haphazard about it, and we really want to put together a tight paper. We have served, as we mentioned, many, many papers. We spent 2 years of serving papers, not one ounce of response back from any of these individuals. We have reported subversion against the United States by enemies, both foreign and domestic, to the United States Supreme Court. We also to both houses of Congress, the President of the United States, and numerous levels on the state level, all governors, the legislative branches of, both houses in all states, sheriffs, and so on. The only one that responded to anything here was the President of the United States. And as I listen and watch over the past couple of years, as Trump has been moving forward, you know, working his work against the deep state and speaking out and having speeches, and every once in a while, there's some statements that come out from his administration or from him himself or even from Q, which is like word for word of some of the things that we've been putting together. Now, of course, we all look at the same Constitution, and we look, of course, at the Declaration of Independence, which is the most recent quote that I've heard from Q, I believe it was. And also, of course, the Bill of Rights, and the Magna Carta, and the history of common law in itself, natural law being common law. So, of course, you know, it's the same sources, so it could be that they're just on the same kind of channel that we're on, so to speak. But anyway, I find it interesting that at least we're on the same page, and that should hopefully make our papers much more powerful. I don't think they're going to be able to withstand this paper in the way we're going to do it as long as we file it when the timing is right. So that's the key. But again, we're pressing forward and we're moving to get this job done as soon as possible. But expedience is not necessarily the best thing sometimes. Okay, let's see, before we move on. Oh, Jan, it looks like you're here. Are you here, Jan, or is Jim taking anything?
I am totally here, yes.
Totally here. It looks
totally
like you
here.
Were. Questions? Any kind of announcements? What do we got?
We have some very interesting questions tonight, John. Would you like to start on those? Okay, the first one. I am a new member to your site, and while reading the disclaimer, we do not encourage or teach people to write declarations, drive without driver's licenses, revoke their voter's application, revoke their birth certificate, or their social security numbers. Please direct me to the information or explain how would you handle these issues.
Well, that's all built upon fraud. Why play in their sandbox? We call it for what it is, fraud. If anybody thinks that they're going to write a declaration and file it with their county and be able to use that when and if the government comes out after you for one issue or another, maybe taxes or something, and that you're going to be able to go into court, make your notice to the court that you had filed some papers, click your heels, and think you're going to be transported out of that court and back into Happy Land, well, then I got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. It's not going to happen. If you were able to really lay the process out before them, which they probably won't let you do it anyway, within that court, you better be really good at it. You better be able to respond to anything that the court can throw at you. Be very articulate. Understand the court that you're in, their powers, their authorities, their positions, and how they respond to people with these things. And believe me, when something new comes into these people, into their courts, they share it amongst themselves as time goes on, and they develop strategies to hammer it out and deal with it. If they think that you're a loner, all alone, and nobody's with you, or maybe one or two people, and you don't really have many people that might be really bearing witness to what's going on. Also, if they feel that you kind of really don't really understand what's really going on, as long as they have a place to hang their hat, you're going to suffer from that court. So going into that court from that perspective is not going to win anybody anything. The key thing is to get out of that court. That's what you have to do. And that's what we talk about, is getting out of these courts. The key thing, of course, is challenging that jurisdiction. And so depending on what court, any court that is run by, operated by statutes, or any court that is brought together with a grand jury indictment that's full of statutes, the violations are all in statute form, and or you're in a court and the trial jury has been instructed by the judge that you get to decide the facts, but I'll tell you what the law is. Well, he's going to tell them statutes. That's jury tampering. Although these are statutory juries, and therefore, again, they don't really have the jurisdiction. There's a problem there, and, of course, it's a unique problem. So understanding the fact that in 1871, for instance, with the Organic Act of 1871, that was the foundation of them being able to construct, or the beginning of constructing their law on a nation, well, let me see, was it called a nation? I guess it would be, or a country within a city, within a city. And that's pretty much what the Organic Act of 1871 had done. And from that point forward, all the way up to present day, they have constructed a lot of law to be attached and built upon that. I truly believe that all this was planned out long time before 1871. And all of the law written up, or most of it, of course, it changed as time goes on. Maybe they altered things. But I think they had this all pre-written out. And each piece is put in and as time goes on. A lot of people don't realize and understand that law is all about construction of law. There's a construction going on. You're building a building. In this case, they're building a prison, a statutory prison. So you have to understand that, too. So when you go into a court, the best thing to do is understand that court, find out the jurisdiction of that court, and then challenge it. And demand that you have a court of record, which a court of record is a court of law, and a court of law is a court of common law, and a court of common law is a court of natural law. They're all synonymous. And that means that it has to be decided by the people as the tribunal, 12 individuals called jurists. And they get to decide everything, including nullification. But if you're not under the government, working for the government, whether you be elected, appointed, or employed, if you're not under those situations, then they can't use any of these titles against you. 26, USC 26, concerning tax court, as we read in that memorandum, is not law. It says right inside itself, it says this is not intended to be law, and yet they use it. And they also, inside titled USC 26, they call themselves a court of record, which means they're claiming to be a natural law court. Yet they're totally controlled and operated by statutes. That's an oxymoron. That's against itself. Therefore, it's a nisi prius, fictional court of unknown jurisdiction, ultimately. And they don't have an answer to jurisdiction, because they don't even have a jurisdiction. So challenging that jurisdiction is going to be a real big burden for them if you pull it into the federal district courts. Federal district judges will have a big, big problem with that. As long as they feel intimidated by you, that you understand what's going on, you have a good opportunity and the ability to win this thing. Also, for violating your unalienable rights of due process and carrying you away into jurisdictions unknown and so on and so forth, at the same time, in these courts, you can sue for damages and restitution. So, again, it's best to understand how things work. The other thing is USC 28. USC 28 is the rules and the procedures of the court. Gets into evidence and how to produce evidence and all kinds of different things. But that has nothing to do with us. That all has to, USC 28 is the rules and the procedures of the title courts, how they operate. They operate, of course, under codes and regulations and statutes, which is all lawful, providing, of course, they don't write anything against the people. But it is lawful to control the bureaucrat, you know, who is elected, appointed, or employed. So we need to understand this. We need to understand how the court moves, how things go. What's the position of the judge? Where is the judge hanging his hat? And I'm sure people understand what I mean by that. If you don't, the point is that the judge does not feel safe, that he has a place to hang his hat, to know that no matter what happens, even if they come after me and they can prove me wrong, I'm still safe. Why? Because he acts in a certain way under certain statutes and so on and so forth. But again, you know, a lot of people, they don't bring up the right words. They don't bring up the right positions. They don't bring up the right argument to be able to put that concern into the heart of the judge, so that the judge starts to think, well, maybe I better not stick with the status quo here, because if they push it beyond and they're nervous of the person pushing it, they might say, well, I'm just not going to take this chance. Usually what they'll try to do, and I've seen this happen, it happened to me, and where they push the other side to work out a deal behind the scenes. I want this out of my court. But if the judge can stick and stay focused on maintaining the status quo, whether it be a corporation or the government itself, to support the conclusion, the desired conclusion that they want, then they're going to enforce that and push that forward. They're going to maintain that status quo. But again, if there's a fear of exposure, risk, they're going to think twice before doing that. So that's where that's kind of at, and I think I answered the question. Anyway, what's next?
Okay, second question. OSC was sent to the then presiding judge of Superior Court of California, County
what's
of Santa Clara. It's undefined, John. It's an acronym for something. I have no idea.
Read it over again. Let me try to think it out. Go ahead. OSC, go ahead.
OSC was sent to the then presiding judge of Superior Court of California, County of Santa Clara, on or about September 27, 2017, and to Superior Court of California, County of Santa Clara, and its presiding judge are in default. And three, the alleged plaintiff, which does not exist, based on facts on records, though it's alleged attorneys without any power of attorney on records, and they have admitted they have none, will be attempting to evict me and my handicapped almost 82-year-old mother of my home of 22-plus years on August 5th, 2019. And four, how do you suggest to stop this misconduct? Would a default letter to the presiding judge and the clerk by certified and registered mail, which I am happy to do if the letter is prepared, be the proper thing to do at this time, knowing there is 3 weeks before jury trial, which I did not ask for. Instead, I wished for a common law trial by jury.
Okay, well, there's a lot of mystery there, but I did get the gist of what this case is about. It seems to be some kind of a foreclosure. I'm not sure whether it's a tax or a mortgage foreclosure, but either one should be handled pretty much the same way. Let me just say before I answer this question, anybody that wants to fight in court and get the answers and get a form or that they can, you know, put into the court, and try to move things in a certain direction. If you're going to do it while you're ignorant to how things work, you're much better off going getting yourself a bar attorney and work out the best deal you can. You're going to pay through the nose, but at least you're not going to pay as much as you would if you try to fight this on your own. And they're going to hammer you down with everything. If they're frustrated enough with you and it's in a situation where they can even incarcerate you, they will do it. If they get frustrated with you, they'll say that you might be crazy. We're going to have a mental evaluation take place on you. And there's not much you're going to be able to do if this court runs out of control down this line. People need to understand what they're into. A lot of places on the Internet here, they're giving people all kinds of ideas and thoughts on, you know, you could do this and you could do that and you could do the other thing. But without the education and understanding how things work, you're really, it's Russian roulette is what you're playing there. So you might fare off better getting yourself a lawyer. Now, with these foreclosures, you're not going to win no matter what you do, except for that you apply it in the proper way. So when we help people, we really strongly suggest and impress upon them, and we hope that they realize and understand what they need to do, is they need to get educated. We can educate you. Okay, just jump into our consent of government course and start using all of the different tools and papers that we have on that page. Let's see, if you go to nationallibertyalliance.org, okay, click on due process, read through that due process page very, very, very carefully. And when you come down to the bottom, you click on a link, and that will bring you into a place where a lot of material. Let me see if I can get to that page, and I'll just run this quickly through a couple of these things that's on here. We have, of course, the Access to National Liberty Alliance's Consent of Government course, which is a definite necessity. It gives you a good overview of everything you really need to really understand. And once the book is out, which hopefully we're hoping to get it out sometime during the fall maybe or the early winter, But once the book is out, which will be a lot of what the course is plus some things, I don't think we're going to put forms into the course, but the forms are available here on this page, and we will put forms in the book. If you were in jail or something and you had this book, because I get a lot of mail from people who are in jail, and they want to know what we have to offer and this, and send brochures and information, you know, we're not set up for that kind of thing. But in any event, they don't allow, it seems, people access into the onto the internet to be able to get some information. So you really get robbed of being able to defend yourself and to learn how to do it. You're kind of forced into dealing with a bar attorney. Well, this book will teach you and lay out everything you really need to know and how it works, including the anatomy of a court case. You know, how things work, how papers are filed, what papers are necessary to file, and so on. So it also would be a reference book. The way we lay it out with an index, we'll be able to get around to really kind of fine-tune what you need to know and pull out what you need quickly and be able to apply it and write papers. There'll be a lot of stuff in there to be able to write papers. We're going to cover the Constitution in depth and, of course, the Declaration of Independence, which is the foundation of our law, the Constitution being the framework of our law, and the Bill of Rights being the capstone of our law. Of course, that's the law that we, the people, ordained and established for our government. We're above it, they're below it. We, on the other hand, answer to no one, no legislative authorities or powers or courts outside of a court of law. And a court of law is defined as natural law court. So, again, education, understanding what you're dealing with, who you're dealing with in a sense. And that's the other thing. You know, you're going to be in court. You better go look up the judge. You know, run that judge's name and you'll get some information real quick and kind of look at some of his rulings and different things that are going on. Find out who he is. And that'll give you more insight on how you might be able to handle things and respond and deal with this individual. So going back to being stuck with a situation with a home, on this page, okay, which is court forms, process, and instructions under due process, and then click the, after you carefully read that due process page, very carefully read it, then at the bottom click the link to access this information. OSC is order to show cause. Okay, thanks. Which is pretty much everything we do is a show cause. Challenging the jurisdiction is a show cause, and that's where we begin. So if you want, you can move your case into our case. We'll write some papers with, from the standpoint of what's called an amicus curiae, coming from the grand jury itself, the federal grand jury, and, talking on your behalf in the court, one paper, and if they fail to obey, we'll send them a final solution. You get the affidavit of default. And if they fail to obey, then we move it into our case, to join it to our case where we will deal with it. Most of the cases that are moving in to our case are cases where the people are really being abused on a family level and particularly on a family level. And also, these non-judicial foreclosures. And even if they're judicial foreclosures, they're still non-judicial foreclosures because they're being operated in courts of equity, operating according to statutes and not law, and the Fifth Amendment prevents them from taking anything from you, including, of course, most importantly, property or life. They can't take that without due process, and those courts are not offering you due process. They may appear or try to appear as if they're offering you due process, and you need to be able to see the difference and recognize it. And again, that comes with experience, you know, where you're really kind of putting yourself in and learning these things. It doesn't necessarily have to be experience in the court. Of course, that's helpful. That gives you a little more boldness. But the important thing is the experience of law, reading and looking and listening. Certain cases we give reference to should be read. United States versus Williams, probably one of the most important cases for what we're doing anyway. One of the most important cases there ever was, in my opinion, United States versus Williams, because it returns back to the people if they respond to it. It returns back to the people the consent of their government to the judicial process. And there's, of course, consent of government from the political process, which people know nothing about. They think the only opportunity they have is to maybe vote in a primary and vote in the general election, and that's it. No. There's a lot more that could be done in taking control of these people and removing them from office. And we'll be teaching, we are teaching this on our site. We're just not speaking much of it at this time because we have to succeed first in the judicial side of things to empower us to deal and succeed on the political side of things. But again, it's the same old story. It's phony, fake things that they put together that looks right and looks like law and looks like power and looks like authority, but it's all null and void. It's null and void. I guess there's nothing more you can say about it. Okay, now getting back to the question. What was the question again? This is about, the show cause. Okay. What we would suggest is to do that, is to join our case, and we'll write some papers and work with you to get your case either dismissed so that they cease and desist, or we move you into the federal district here as a joinder into our case, which is really evidence to us, but we're even going to take it further than that and move it forward for some conclusions and getting at least at bare minimum restitution to be brought back to your original state before all this nightmare started. But anybody who's not in court right now, okay, well, now's the time to prepare because tomorrow you could be. But, you know, again, we need to do what we have to do and take power and back and give it to the people on a grassroots level. Next question.
Okay. Next question is, when are we going to serve show cause orders on our elected servants when they fail to support the Constitution as their oath prescribes?
We've been doing it for 2 years. We've goodness, hundreds of papers we've filed. I mentioned this a little while ago. We've filed it on both houses at the federal level. We filed it on the United States Supreme Court, federal judiciary in all 94 federal districts, all chief judges, which were also commanded to put this paper out to all other judges underneath their umbrella, so to speak. We've also filed with every governor, all 50 states. We filed the papers and served them on both houses in every state. We served papers over 3,100 sheriffs, something like that. Sheriffs for every county. We also filed it in through the state courts, all of these papers. So we have filed hundreds of papers to thousands of people over the past 2 years. We hear nothing but silence, with the exception of President Donald Trump. So we've already done it. Now we're at the tail end of that. We're at the finale, the final paperwork to be served, and pressed upon and pressed upon and pressed upon and added to and added to and pressed upon. This requires the people. And if the people don't want to be free, if they don't want to get educated, they don't want to be free. They don't want to have liberty. If they don't want to step up and get behind this this movement that we've got going to restore justice in America, then you don't want liberty. And if the people don't step up, you're not going to have it. So if the people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. Not going to happen. If the people expect liberty without working for it, forget about it. You're not going to have it. So it's up to the people to make that decision right now, what it is they want to do. Next question.
Okay, a friend of ours had an IRS audit in their own home a few years back. During the sit-down in the living room, the auditor randomly asked if there was any money in the house. If anyone is ever confronted with such invasive questions, how should they respond or react?
Well, first of all, I would never allow them into my home to have an interview. You know, when I, many, many years ago, being in business many, many years ago, going back 30, maybe 40 years, 35 years, something, I did have an audit, and they did come to my house for that, and I learned from that. But nevertheless, I don't answer them. They have to look at if they're if well again it depends on what's going on here. I mean, if you've been reporting every year, and if you're a business reporting every year, you know you're kind of stuck in that game, and you're not going to be able to get out of it. So you're going to have to continue to play the tax game. It'd be very difficult for you to get out. Not that you can't, but you've already acquiesced to them. You've already agreed to them, and you better be really good and efficient in understanding how these things work if you're going to change on that. I don't believe they're going to be here, the IRS and the Federal Reserve. I don't think they're going to be here a year or two from now. And listening, is anybody listening to Trump? He's putting out lots of little messages that probably makes that pretty clear, I think. Now, for those people who have been kind of just running for away from these people and being able to just stay away, and then they catch up with you, that's a whole new story now. For those people, okay, very first order of business needs to be, where's your proof of claim? And I would go up and I'd download the form 4490. You can Google it. When I first Googled these forms, they were very easy and quick to get, and they popped up very quickly, and they still do. And you can go to that page, read it, download it, right there. But I found now that you go out there and you put these forms in, you hit a lot of sites that are put up on the beginning that want you to pay for this form 4490. But it's worth, I guess, the buck or two or whatever they're going to charge you for the form. But if you hunt around the Internet, you'll find it free anyway. So 4490 is proof of claim. And that's an affidavit form required for the IRS to fill out in order to use it against you. That's their evidence. The problem for them is that they never fill it out and they can't swear to it. Because they know that everything they do is a fraud. For instance, if they're chasing you for money and they don't know anything, let's say they find the bank account and they see over the course of a year $60,000 went through that bank account or $100,000, whatever it is, okay? Whatever that number is, first of all, they break into your bank account unlawfully. We'll talk maybe another time about that and how that works, but they get into your bank account unlawfully. They give you authority. They don't really have authority. They give you some codes, and they say this is authority, and if you dig deep, you'll find out you can beat that pretty easily. There is the, oh goodness, what's this called? I can't think of the name of it, but in any event, they don't have that power or authority to get in there, but they do. And the banks comply with them. Once you notify the bank, before they can do anything, they got to give you a notice of the intent of what they're going to do. And so when they send something to the bank, they send you a copy. Banks have to wait 7 days, at least this is the way it's supposed to be, before they can turn anything over to the IRS. Okay? If you don't respond to that bank and say, don't do it, because I'm going to sue you if you do, this is without due process, and so on and so forth, they might hold off. But lately they've been pretty bold. They don't care. They hold the 7 days. If they hold the 7 days, they still give it to them anyway. But anyway, let's say there was $60,000 in that account. Well, now they're going to say you owe $60,000 in taxes. This is a ploy that they use in order to try to talk to you, to try to get a conversation going, to try to debate it. Come down, let's talk about it. If you don't like our decision, well, you know, here, you can challenge it in a tax court. Just file this paperwork here, and we'll talk about it there then. Of course, all of that is giving them authority to go forward. That's the problem. So, you know, you got to be real careful, and you have to respond to everything. I would respond with a request. Well, you say, $40,000 or whatever it is. Well, that's all news to me. I have no idea how that could be. You know, write a letter with that kind of an idea or thinking. Please send me a copy of your proof of claim. And you know, I'll attach a copy. It's a 4490 attached to the letter, and then send it to them. Certify it. I notarize any letter I have to the IRS. I get notarized and I send it out return slip, you know, certified mail. And so I have all the proof and I attach that to the original letter that I'm responding to. I refer to that number on the letter and the date and everything. You see, if you don't respond to their letters, they'll send you a series of letters, letter after letter after letter after letter after letter. And if you look down on the bottom, all these letters have numbers. And so it's a process they're going through. And they're looking for you to not answer, because when you don't answer, you're acquiescing. And when you're acquiescing, you just gave them the authority. Resist the first, Optus Principis, I believe it's pronounced. I'm not sure on the pronunciation, but anyway, we read about that in the memorandum we read earlier, which means resist the first, okay? So you need to resist these people. Do not give them the authority. Do not give them agreement with anything they're saying or doing, and don't acquiesce by not answering. I wouldn't bother. I used to bother, you know, writing all kinds of stuff, trying to educate them and tell them what the taxes are, you know, all the stuff that I know that the fraud is built upon, and that doesn't go anywhere. No one's reading those papers anyway. So just stick to the point, keep it simple, and ask for, you know, the required paper. If they try to you know, seize your property or something of that nature, you want to look for their fiduciary authority to do so. You had no, there's been no due process, so where's your fiduciary authority, you know? And they come upon you in a process called INREM, I-N-R-E-M. And when they come out here in REM, what they're saying is that you're a pirate, and we're not going to go, we don't have to serve the pirate for the seizure. We go directly and seize the property, and the whole focus is on the property. We bring it into shore, into port, and in 30 days, if it's not, if the pirates don't come in and say, hey, that's my ship, you know, I want it back, of course they'll go to jail. But if they come in to do that, then they have the opportunity of due process. So they sit there for 30 days in the port, or 45 days, whatever it is, and then the seizure is done in REM. And the country who sees the pirate ship then takes total control, and whatever they're going to do with it, sell it or whatever. Well, that's how they come out after the people, the IRS comes out after you, in a process called INREM. So in order to do that, since they're not giving you, first of all, you can argue the due process that you're not getting, but other than that, where is your fiduciary authority? You see, who gave you the authority to deal with my property? See, because you're not a pirate, you're not worried about being arrested because you know, you did some evil with the property. So now you can challenge it. So those are the things people need to understand and really deal with these things on that level. But again, if you don't understand how these things work, you're committing suicide is what you're doing. Go get yourself a bar attorney or learn how to be free and have true liberty by understanding the real law. You know, not the man on the land stuff, which really amounts to nothing because it's all fraud. Let's call it for what it is. Don't play in their sandbox. Take it into a court of law and deal with it. And that's it. But again, you know, if you've been dealing with the IRS for a long time, paying your taxes, and maybe you're in business or something, it's a lot more difficult. I'd say stick with the course you've been on, keep yourself out of jail, and hope and wait for things to change in the next year or two, which I do believe they're going to. You know, Trump put out that he's the idea of not, what they call it, the Federal Reserve notes. I don't think they were called notes, Federal Reserve something. Not the Federal Reserve, I'm sorry. Federal Reserve notes is debt. But there is another, I forget what they call it, slips my memory of what a real dollar is. I know Kennedy put out silver certificates, and they took care of that problem by taking care of Kennedy, of course. But, you know, but Trump is moving in the same direction Kennedy went. He understands that he could make this monetary collapse a very, very slow, controlled demolition with minimum damage to the people, maintaining also our economic system without having to totally crash and make a transition. And just over the weekend, he was talking about this dollar, if anybody's been paying attention. Okay, what's next?
Well, next we have, the question is tax lien versus judgment tax lien. A legislative body can call it a statutory lien without any due process of law, yet when confronted and you demand the court order lien, they all go silent. I know this because I have both the statutory lien and the letter from the town attorney stating no judgment lien for no due process in court. So one must inquire, if no lien, it's no lien?
No, there is no lien. Look, even on when they do a tax foreclosure on your house, for instance, believe it or not, they literally have it written up in the books on the state level, and the counties react on this, to seize the property in rem. R-E-M. They don't understand what that means. And I didn't have the personal conversation with an attorney, the town attorney, but Gerard did, and because we were working on problems that he had with taxes and stuff. And he asked the attorney, well, what does that mean, in rem? And he responded, I have no clue. I haven't been able to figure that out. I don't know anybody who knows it. They don't know what that means. We know what it means. It's a federal process, and it's first of all, it's the law of the sea, and it's against the pirates. It's a piracy thing, and so that's what it means: seizing property at sea, and not filing the papers upon the person, but upon the object. Okay, in rem is serving the papers upon the object, towing it into port, and you know, going through the process, the regular legal process that they have set up for, you know, maritime law. And so what they've done is they've applied that on the land, and the states have picked up on it. So here's the fact of the matter. Anybody, if the IRS comes out after you and they serve on to you, they tell you, well, we're going to file a notice of lien. Now, I remember when I first heard that, I was trying to figure out what the hell is a notice of lien. And a lot of people, you know, they don't really, you know, don't understand it either. Well, I discover what a notice of lien is. A notice of lien is filed in your county. And so they file it with the county clerk. And the county clerk, what that notice of lien is, it's usually an IRS agent that'll file it. And what they're saying is that we have a federal lien in the federal district court here in this case, the Southern District of New York. We have a lien filed there. So we're filing a notice of that lien existing in the federal court, okay? And they have to give you 7 days notice, and you need to respond within that 7 days notice. You need to go after your bank. You need to go after the sheriff. You need to go after the clerk. You need to go after the agents and get your papers in to prevent the seizure of property without the due process part. And so you have to protect yourself there. But in that, what they don't, the problem is, of course, there are two forms that have to be filed in order to have the lien. in order to file the lien in the federal court to be able to put the notice of lien in the county. Okay? And that, of course, is Form 56 and Form 4490. And if you go down to the federal court, you will find no such papers exist in the filing on your property or yourself. And they do this all the time. That there is fraud. And if they know that you know, and the judge knows that you know, he's got a big dilemma here, you know, because now he's got to say, am I going to take the risk and stick with the status quo here on this? Because this guy figured it out. He sees, you know, the problem, and it's not there. Well, turns out, if they're going to do something in REM, they're dealing with the law of the sea, they're dealing with a federal situation, they too have to file the papers in the federal district court in order to go forward to try to get some kind of a lien so that they send the sheriff out on you. And there's a lot of little games that they play with the moving around of the property and changing the ownership and robo-signing and all kinds of stuff that manipulates. It usually takes a couple of years to go through that process. But the tax, because it's the government, they go through very quickly. You know, they file it in 1 month, and 3 months later, you're losing your property, and sheriff's got to kick you out. So you have to be careful with the tax liens there. But jurisdictional challenge is the key on that level to begin with. Putting upon them, where is the papers filed? Because I didn't find them down at the federal court. Bring a lawsuit against them. Turn that court into a court of record. If there's a court case open, turn that court into a court of record. Challenge the jurisdiction. Come in and countersue them with that for restitution, being restored back to the original state of being, whatever that might have been. And if they ignore it and deny it and move forward, move it into federal court for cause and go beyond that for damages beyond just restoring you to your original state. You can now get damages and move from there. I think I answered the question. Jan, you're muted?
I was checked. Can the sheriff arrest the judge in court if the judge is openly violating his oath of office to the Constitution?
Well, I guess in theory, but I don't think that would be the right way to go about it, and I don't think it would be wise for a sheriff to do that. And I would think he would wait until he got off the bench and went to his office and then, you know, got a conversation with the judge and say, hey, judge, you know, you're breaking the law here. And I would think that the sheriff should at least give them the opportunity. Although I'd like to see these guys go to jail, some of these judges really don't even know what the heck they're doing. If you're dealing with a town judge, he hasn't got a clue. Town, village, they just don't have a clue. County judges probably don't have a clue, and same thing with state judges. You know, they've really been bamboozled by what they think is the law that is not. I don't know about federal judges. I think federal judges know, and some state judges know. Matter of fact, I think a lot of state judges know. But look, at first order of business is letting the judge know that they're breaking the law. You go back and restore this problem. Give them the opportunity. If they don't go back and fix the problem, then for sure he should be arrested. But I would definitely, if I was the sheriff, I definitely wouldn't arrest him on the bench, that's for sure. I think that's a little too bold and not sure of the repercussions on that one. Next.
Okay. If a mother's parental rights were terminated based upon fraudulent child abuse charges that she was later acquitted of, can she get back her child if the child was adopted out by the state agency?
Absolutely. They had no power or authority to do that in the first place. These courts are not courts of justice. They're courts of injustice. Challenging jurisdiction is first order of business and dealing with this problem. Most of these, charges against people for abuse is not real. There are some, I'm sure, that are, but generally speaking, they're just not real. They're just abusing the people. and taken their opportunists, take an opportunity. And often, more often than not, someone angry with somebody does something stupid, and next thing you know, the CPS is out there and you're dealing with a major problem. But yeah, I'd go after them with everything I got. They wouldn't survive, if it's up to me, going through the courts. I would go out after everything. They tried to steal my children. But mine are all grown up now, so. But, challenging jurisdiction is the beginning. Absolutely. If they took your child, and especially you, at the end of the day, sounds like you've been in courts for a long time, but at the end of the day, the charges didn't stick and they adopted your children out, well, I want my children back. Absolutely. They may try to say, oh, it's too late, we've already done it, this, that. I wouldn't care less. I'd go suing everybody right up the line and right, straight on through, whatever I had to do. Next.
That's all of them, John.
Okay. Any announcements?
Just the same as last week, John. We're still looking for people, as we have been. We need more welcome committee members.
People, if you want to be free, get active. If you want liberty, get active. If you don't want liberty and you don't want to be free and have that liberty, then forget about it. Don't worry about nothing. Keep doing what you're doing. But look at, liberty is not free. It just isn't, unfortunately. It's given liberally by God to us, but we still have to stand up for it. We have to defend it. And if we're not willing to step up and defend it, learn it and defend it, then we don't deserve it. So go ahead, Jan. What do we need?
Well, we need welcome committee members. We had 12 originally, and we've lost some of them. Some have gone to other committees and so on. We need to replace them. We can't keep up unless we can keep about a dozen of them working. We also need more people to print out copies of these new documents we're generating. I've got, I think it's 17 volunteers now. Had a couple more this week. We need probably 75 to 100 to do the job. And we're still looking for more, two or three volunteers to give us a hand. Contacting hosts so we can get you and Gerard on their programs. And the last is we need someone to do a little research, maybe two or three people, to just find us a list of donors and addresses, and so we can post them on the website and people can send them these donation request letters that we've generated. If we post them on the website, hopefully several people will pick each name and send them multiple copies. It can't hurt to let people know that we have more than one person here in this organization, and they think that we need to have some support from some of these people that donate to liberty causes and so on. So we have those four different areas, and they're all important, and we need help in all of them.
Okay.
And that's about it.
All right. Thank you very much, Jan. Okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to move over to Brent. I see Brent is here. And after that, we'll open up for an open forum for questions or comments and so on. Brent, are you ready? I see he just unchecked himself, so he's ready. Okay, Brent Winters, he's the author of The Excellence of the Common Law, great book. Anybody who's studying and working through things, what we're doing, this is a great book to get because it really gives you a good sense and understanding of natural law. And I think I could say that it was kind of a difficult book the first time I read it because I was ignorant to so many things. I only knew sort of the man on the land kind of stuff and a few things here or there, but I was really starting to really learn about the law. And it was my second time around reading the book that really I found it to be a great book to really enhance my understanding. So anyway, Common Law, The Excellence of the Common Law by Brent Allen Winters. And Brent is a common lawyer. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you. And the only remedy for lawlessness is true law. And we have the law defined for us as Americans, and I'll be thankful. The laws of nature, that is the lex non scripta, that means the law not written, that means our common law. And then the laws of nature's God, it says. Well, that's lex scripta. And William Blackstone, in his commentaries, tells us that that phrase refers to the law written, the Bible itself, all 66 writings. So it's not like we're without an understanding of what our fundamental law is as Americans. It sets us apart by official proclamation of what it is. We have used it all this time, all these decades, and we've rested squarely upon it without any question we have. I think it's axiomatic that we in America have rested on the Bible. It's downright silly to say that we haven't. Whether you like it or not, it's just a fact of history. But I would say that it has contributed immensely to the reality that we have been the most wealthy producer of wealth in the history of Adam's race. The difference between the law of the land and the law of the city is the great difference that's purposely ignored, has been for a long time. Nothing new. It's our duty to continually revive in the consciousness of our fellow countrymen what our law is. Our law is not Sharia law. It's not other law such as the canon or the Code of Justinian, the canon laws of Rome and the Roman Imperial Church. That's not our law. It never has been. It still isn't. And we need to make sure it's that way, because the law of the city hasn't any commitment to due process. The law of the land is due process, and without due process, we're in bad shape. Speaking of the law of the land, our common law is always held that it's utterly against the law to arrest a judge, whether it be a sheriff or a private citizen. It's against the law to arrest a judge while he's on the bench holding court. Don't try it. Had a fellow call me one time, wanted to ask me some questions, and said, well, if this judge rules against me, it's clear that he's breaking the law and committing a felony, and I'm going to arrest him on the spot. I said, well, I think you better rethink that, better rethink it. Why? Well, because our law says it's against the law to arrest a judge while he's holding court. A judge can be arrested after he's off the bench, after the hearing is over, after the trial's over, but not while he's on the bench. And there's a reason for that, and it's a good one. And without some form of order, and that's a form of order, a minimal one, but without it, the chaos would consume us. There would be utter lawlessness. Remember again, our common law does not stress the do's and the don'ts. Do this, don't do that. It stresses how we go about deciding who did what and when, where and how, and then what should be the penalty. There's a process that goes to that. And if the process isn't followed, it's called due process, then our conclusions are no good. Well, we were talking also about in rem jurisdiction. Well, it can be a complicated subject. But then again, it can be stated in simplicity. Of course, when it's applied, it can be a mess. Bottom line, in rem is an old Latin word that just means at the thing. Rem is the word in English that means thing or matter, or more like thing. Thing, and thing is a significant word, common law. The thing, the thang, or the thung, depending upon which dialect of the Scandinavian or Germanic languages one speaks, the thing was the jury, or sometimes it was the body of elders, the eldership, as they used to say. And those are the fellows that would, the jury would make decisions. The jury's been around for centuries, way before Magna Carta. Magna Carta is just another, not just another restatement, it is another restatement. But in rem is against the thing. I was looking. These in rem cases are really kind of fascinating. There's a case from 1916 called the United States versus 40 barrels and 20 kegs of Coca-Cola. The United States versus 40 barrels and 20 kegs of Coca-Cola. See, normally it'd say the United States versus, then it would have a name of a person. Well, if it was a person, that would be in personam jurisdiction. That means at the person. The case was charged at the person. Well, these cases, though, as was said a while ago, they're admiralty kind of cases, a lot of them, but they have to do with aiming a case at a thing and going after the thing. That's been happening a long time. I mean, if a sheriff has a writ of replevin, he's not got a writ that says go out and arrest a man or a person. he'd got a writ that says go out and get this car this fellow had been making payments on, or break down a door and get something out of a house if he has a warrant. That can happen. Our Constitution addresses that. It says no warrants shall issue unless the person to be seized, the person or thing to be seized. Person, if you're going to seize a person, you have a warrant. That gives the sheriff or the marshal or the arresting person jurisdiction against that person to go after that person. That's in personam. But if you have the warrant says you're going to seize, what does it say here, 40 barrels of Coca-Cola, like this case, well, that's a authority over a thing. So in rem is the court's authority or jurisdiction to deal with a thing. In this particular case, a fellow named Wiley was head of the United States Department of Agriculture Bureau of Chemistry, and Congress had just passed the Pure Food and Drug Act. This is fascinating. Listen to this. And the Bureau, the U.S. Bureau, that particular bureaucracy, started prosecuting companies which were selling products with harmful components and companies which were making misleading claims about their products. Remember, that was just before World War I. And in the year 1903, Coca-Cola had already started using spent coca leaves, which carried a small trace of cocaine, and had dropped the claim that it cured headaches. They used to say, drink Coca-Cola, it'll cure headaches. Well, the reason they said that, because it did, because it had a happy element in it called cocaine, make you happier. Your headache would go away. But they'd taken out most of that, still had a trace of it, but it still contained caffeine. And Wiley, the head of this bureaucracy, believed that even small amounts of caffeine in beverages were harmful to people. Well, maybe he was a Seventh-day Adventist or a Mormon or something. I don't know. So he was worried that Coca-Cola was being consumed by children as young as 4 years old. So in the year 1909, he ordered the seizure of 40 barrels and 20 kegs. Remember, a keg, I believe, is a quarter of a barrel of Coca-Cola shipment. And the government initiated the case. He took it to court. He didn't sue anybody. He charged these 40 barrels. It is an admiralty law kind of a thing. And I don't think he did real well with the case. I think he lost. Yeah, he did, because this legislation didn't address caffeine so much. But there are a lot of cases like that. There's cases against 40 barrels of whiskey. A case back in 1876, a fella took 40 barrels of whiskey to an Indian reservation in Minnesota, and the government went after the 40 barrels, said that it had the right to regulate the sale of whiskey to the Indian tribes. Well, under a treaty it had with the tribes. But it's just simply, without getting into the complications that can arise, it's against a thing and not a person. That's in rem jurisdiction. Well, let's talk about taxation a little bit. And we've been going through the Constitution of the United States. We talked about income taxation. We talked about the head tax, the poll tax, as the old word would have put it. And there's a sharp disagreement, has been for a long time, over whether income taxation results from the confusion that all three branches of the general government foster. The confusion the government fosters by refusing to grab the nettle with the bare hand and decide the weightier questions of our income tax law, of course, won't do it. Unconstitutional income tax collection now embodies government lawlessness and emboldens it, too, drawing swarms of ignorant clerks, unprincipled agents, and dishonorable bureaucrats, striking fear and confusion into elected officials, judges, and jurors, resulting in wholesale disrespect for the Bill of Rights and low tax revenues. Tax revenues would even be higher. But remember, the income tax does not exist. It never existed so that the government would have money to pay for the services it says it provides. That's never why it's existed. And not one thin dime of income tax goes to pay for services to government. Now, I say that on the authority of the Grace Commission, named after a man by the name of Grace, ordained and put in force by Ronald Reagan, pursuant to a promise a campaign promise he made that he would study the income taxation and see if we could make a change. The Grace Commission studied the income tax system, and they said not one thin dime of federal income tax goes to services that the government says it provides. Not one thin dime goes to national defense, paying soldiers and sailors. Not one thin dime goes to paying congressmen. Not one thin dime goes to paying for roads and interstate highway systems and repairs. That's an incredible statement. Now, could that have changed since that day? I think it could have, but I know that the purpose of income tax is not to raise money. The purpose, they print all the money they want. They, those guys, the evil empire, they print money, the Federal Reserve Bank. They print it. They have a counterfeit operation going. And when they pump exorbitant amounts of printed money into the system, whether by computer entry or on paper, as it was not too many years ago, when they do that, that inflates the dollar, makes the dollar worth less, because there's a glut in the system of dollars. Well, it could spin out of control when they do that. So in order to try to keep it in check, there are two things they have to do. Number one, they print money. When they need it, they print it. That's right. No, don't say that Congress holds the purse strings. That's a popular thing to say. They don't. That's not true ever since they've been printing money wholesale and counterfeiting it. Congress doesn't control that. And we'd like to think they do, but they don't. Oh, they make a show of it. It looks like the window dressing of it, but it isn't true. So they print money, but when they pump too much into the system, they have to have a way to keep it from blowing up, inflation to run out of hand and destroying the goose that lays the golden egg, the producer of wealth in America, the worker, the man that works the land, he mines the minerals, he cuts the timber, he works in a factory adding value, he works as a builder, he's a man who adds value to land, all sorts of people like that. They add value. That's where the wealth comes from, not from the money. Well, they pump the system full. They've got to have a way to relieve that inflation. It's like a balloon. It just pumps up. They've got to have a way to get that off, siphon some of it off. And that's what the income tax system is for. And that's why the federal income tax system was put in place right at the same time, almost at the same time, pretty close, to the time that the Federal Reserve Bank was chartered. The Federal Reserve Bank established a system of counterfeiting. And then the income taxation was put in place about the same time so that there would be a regulating mechanism that could pull money out of the system, pull it off the books, you see. And then it wouldn't, that's how they do it. Well, that's what taxation is all about, income taxation. It's an evil system. It's an unlawful system, according to our common law. It taxes something that our law has always said is a direct tax. And it is a turning upside down of all the principles that it can of our common law. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5 says this: no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. Wow. No tax or duty shall be laid on any articles exported from any state. In this clause, exported means shipped from one state to a sister state or to a foreign country or to an Indian tribe. An Indian tribe, the nations, as they used to call them, the Indian nations. The southern states feared in that day when the Constitution was ratified. The southern states feared that the new general government in Washington, D.C. would tax their farm exports and destroy their welfare. The truth is, in those early days, back then, when our country started, the only part of the country that exported anything to amount to anything was the southern states. I mean, all of the goods that came from the Midwest in those days, the few people that lived in the Midwest, there weren't that many, but even the people that lived in the Allegheny Mountains, let's just go to that, up at the head of the Ohio River and the Allegheny River and the Monongahela and where the Ohio went up toward West Virginia, there was trade that came by flatboat down those rivers. All that trade, if they couldn't get it to the East Coast and get it to the ocean, as agricultural products, primarily corn turned into whiskey, that was a big item, they would ship it down those rivers. Increasingly, it went down the Ohio by flatboat and to New Orleans. So if there was exports, It came out of the South, you see. It didn't come out of the states in the heartland of America. It didn't come out of the places even where the Alleghenies were in Pennsylvania, where the moonshiners were so prevalent, and on down into Kentucky, where they became more prevalent as those settlers went down those long mountains into the southern states. But still, the southern states, Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia in that day, produced agricultural products, tobacco and cotton. And those were big export products, and they were afraid that the northern states, because they were more populous, would have more power in Congress and would tax them to support the federal government. And they were right. That's no doubt what would have happened. So they demanded that this clause be put in here, and this clause bars such a tax. And like the Commerce Clause, it aims at keeping government from putting a damper on commerce between sister states and exports to other countries. So consequently, Congress has been unrelenting from the ratification of the Constitution until very recently, and still are unrelenting as far as we know. As far as we know, the last big case on this clause was in 1996. And they affirmed it. No, there will be no taxes on goods leaving, exported from the United States. Section 9, Clause 6, no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another, nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another. And we're talking admiralty jurisdiction here. Keep in mind, our Constitution of the United States grants admiralty jurisdiction to the general government of the United States over all navigable waters and other things. Then there's been cases that say what pertains to navigable waters. It's an exclusive jurisdiction. And all federal courts, potentially, have admiralty jurisdiction. And I'd like to add, that's why the admiralty flag hangs often in federal courts. That gold fringe flag. Is that an admiralty jurisdiction? Well, if there's an admiralty case, yeah, they have admiralty jurisdiction in that court. There's nothing really unusual about the idea of showing that this has admiralty jurisdiction. As a matter of fact, in the early decades of our country, the bread and butter of the cases that went to federal court were admiralty jurisdiction, because the state courts handled everything else. There was very little left to the federal courts. There were only, and there still are, only four kinds of crimes that the Constitution talks about that could possibly be crimes of federal jurisdiction of the federal courts. And those four types of crimes are the crimes called counterfeiting the securities and coin of the United States. Counterfeiting, that's a federal crime, our Constitution mentions. Piracies and felonies committed on the high seas is a federal crime, our Constitution mentions. That means it's an admiralty jurisdiction problem. It's a federal jurisdiction, just like counterfeiting. And then there is violations of international law. That's a federal jurisdiction. And then finally, the fourth and the final kind of crime our Constitution mentions could be granted to federal government is treason against the United States. Now, each of the states also, and well, I shouldn't say I've looked at every one of them, but I know some of them do, they have a treason against the state. If you commit treason against your state, you'll be executed in some states. John Brown, you know, the one that they wrote the song about, John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. Well, that guy was trying to start an insurrection to free all the slaves in the South. And it didn't work out the way he wanted. He stole weapons. He barricaded himself in an engine house at Harper's Ferry on federal property. And by a strange coincidence, the military officer nearest by to take control of the situation was Robert E. Lee. This is before the breaking up of the Union and the war. And the President of the United States commissioned Lee, said, go and storm that engine house and arrest John Brown. And he did. And he used the United States Marines. He wasn't the United States Marine, but those are the only federal troops available. He took them. They stormed the engine house. There were some people injured and killed, and he got John Brown. But John Brown was turned over to the state of Virginia, and the state of Virginia tried him for treason and executed him, hung him. There's the sovereignty of the states. That is a strange quirk of twisting that would happen just before the state of Virginia left the Union. And, of course, declared its sovereignty by that, too. But those are the four kinds of crimes. Those are crimes that our Constitution mentions. And the states of Virginia and Kentucky passed, the legislatures passed what they called the Resolutions of 98. That's 1798, not long after our country started. And they made note that they saw that the general government, the federal government in Washington, D.C., was at that time overstepping its boundaries and making things crimes that our Constitution had not mentioned. They saw the national government going in the wrong direction, and they said they weren't going to participate. Another precursor to that terrible war, the federal government overstepping its bounds. Well, this clause about no preference shall be given to one state over another, or one port over another. This clause bars any state from taxing a ship coming to that state from a sister state. It further bars Congress from making a law concerning trade that favors one state over another because such favoritism hampers interstate commerce, disrupting its free-flowing regularity. Now notice the Constitution says that the federal government in Washington, D.C., cannot lawfully tax imports. Well, what about exports? Cannot tax exports. Well, what about imports? Didn't say anything about that. And boy, did they ever pour on the import tax in favor of one state over another. And of all the things that precipitated, that fostered the breaking up of the Union of States in that terrible war, where 600,000 casualties occurred, was that the federal government was putting a tax on goods that were only coming into the southern states. And I don't mean small taxes. I mean huge taxes. Well, who's going to pay those taxes of import tax? The consumers in the states, they paid it. It's passed along. Remember the difference between a direct tax and an indirect tax? A direct tax is a tax you can't pass along to somebody else. A sales tax, the merchant, he pays it. He can pass it along to the consumer, you see. He adds it to whatever he's selling. The gasoline, he adds it to the gasoline. The consumer pays that tax. So that's not a direct tax. A direct tax, that's a tax you can't pass on to another person. Like a tax that says everybody in the United States has to send a dollar to the federal government. You can't pass that along to somebody else. Well, that's what happened because there is no prohibition against import taxes, and that can be discriminatory very much. And they skinned the southern people alive. That's fact of history, skinned them alive. They destroyed their economy with import taxation, and that's one of the reasons why they went to war. Well, let's look at one more, and then we better call in the dogs. Section 9, Clause 7. No money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. This clause bars anyone in any of the three branches of the federal government from spending any national government money without Congress's consent. Do you think they're following this one? In addition, the general government must publish financial statements from time to time, as often as the people by their representatives in Congress demand. In all events, Congress alone must hold the purse strings. Well, they must, but they can't anymore, as I said a while ago. As long as the counterfeiting operation continues with the Federal Reserve Bank, Congress doesn't have any power. They don't control those purse strings. Counterfeiting. Who was it in the general government about 60, 70 years ago said something about this wonderful money-making machine? Well, that's what the Federal Reserve System is. It's a wonderful money-making machine. Make money out of thin air and bypass Congress, print the stuff. You can print it for war or welfare. It doesn't make any difference. Anything it desires to effect, political manipulation, can do what it wants, get away with it. So that's why Ron Paul said he'd boil down our problems to one thing. Well, he came pretty close. He said, end the Fed. End the Fed. He wrote a book about it. That's what could be done. Well, that's all. Well, that's enough for today. Lord willing, we'll start where we left off last time. Join us on Saturday mornings. We've gone through 45 weeks of the law of common law of evidence, and now we're in the, I believe it's the 18th week of the common law of contracts, the law of promises. And you can see me, but I can't see you. You can watch me, and I talk a while, and then we have some discussion, assignment, certificate, if you want in the end. You do the assignments, but join us. For now, we just want you to take advantage of me as long as I'm willing. When I'm not willing, I guess it'll stop. Right now, you can do it if you want. Saturday mornings, go to www.commonlawyer.com and go to the events button and scroll down. And you can find there a link to click on that allows you to either listen on your telephone, listen or watch on your smartphone, or listen or watch on your computer. And as always, my statements are my own and may not necessarily be the positions of National Liberty Alliance. And I thank them for allowing me a few minutes. Back to you, John.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. Okay, I guess we'll move over now to an open forum. Anybody have any questions or comments? They can get into the queue, *6 and a 1 to get into the queue, *6 and a 1 to get into the queue. Okay, we'll take up, and you know what we'll do is we only want one question per person. Maybe they can have a follow-up on the same subject matter or something. They can have a follow-up or two. But, you know, after that, then they should... you know, if they want to have another question, they can get back into the queue. So we can make sure we get through all the people that are in the queue. Okay, first caller is Kat, K-A-T, VoIP dialer. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, John. John, good evening. Good call this evening. My question surrounds a petition that I put into the U.S. District Court regarding no notice of deficiency being provided and no notice of determination concerning collection action. I sent that to the court. It was returned to me basically saying, and also a letter accompanying asking if the U.S. District Court had jurisdiction over the IRS. Everything was sent back to me. They filed it and then sent it back to me dismissed, saying that I did not pay the court fee. So my question at this point is, can I use that at this point to challenge the jurisdiction against the judge that dismissed it, or should refile?
Let me ask you, when they said you didn't file the fee, so it's an existing case and they want you to file the fee for to move the court. Is that what they want?
Yeah, actually, what I did is I filed, it's a petition kit that's in the U.S. District Court, and I basically sent the form in. It does ask you for a $60 fee. But there's a conversation around this fee that if you pay the fee, it brings you into their jurisdiction. So therefore, I didn't send the fee. And then they filed it, and they served it, and then they dismissed it and sent me a letter back saying that the case was dismissed because I did not provide the fee. The court.
Well, look, there's a lot of positions you could probably take on this and move forward. And, you know, I like once you lay out the rules of the court, did you file this case or did they file it against you?
I filed.
Okay, and the case you filed, what kind of a case is it? I don't need a lot of detail, just some basic information.
Yeah,
what kind of a case?
It's in regards to letters I'm getting from the IRS. for taxes that they're wanting to collect from me, which I basically have said, "Oh, you know, this is not something that I want to proceed with." So I changed everything. I did the filing, like the crack the code method, and some of these years, and they returned basically saying, you know, we don't agree, and they're basically sending me nasty letters and telling me, penalizing me for $5,000, $10,000, and so forth. So the next move that I did is basically to come in and say, okay, I haven't received any notice of deficiency, I haven't received any notice of determination concerning the collection action. I want everything dismissed and move along. So,
all right, well, look, you can make the position. First of all, when you file the case, do you know about how to open a court of record and to make sure you get jurisdiction up there?
Right. I do understand that, but this was using their form, so their petition. So, and I'm using my actual, you know, name, and then my married name and all the different, you know, names that they're addressing me with in these letters, basically.
Okay. Have you responded to every letter that the IRS has sent you?
Oh, yeah, I respond to those guys.
Okay, so you respond
time.
To everything, and you got proof of that response.
Absolutely. I got, you know, certified return receipt and everything.
Did they put some number up against you saying you owe us X amount of dollars for certain years?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
They got access into your bank accounts and probably pulled numbers?
Not yet. So I'm basically just trying to get ahead of
the game. Where are they getting the numbers from, do you know?
They're getting the initial numbers from my employer, because my employer sent them, of course, the information.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of difficult because they're reporting the crime, so to speak. You know, they're reporting on the monies, and when you don't file, they're calling it a crime and so on and so forth. Okay. So, look, the key thing is maintaining and keeping your jurisdiction. I filed with the federal court one case against the IRS and others. And I originally done it through the mail, filling out all the papers, and the judge sent it back demanding money. And I responded. I gave them their money to get in, and made a big thing about the toll being charged and that justice is free. And, you know, there's court cases you quote. There's American jurisprudence makes that point and could be quoted and so on. And that this is a court of record. And I gave the money and the duress, and I want my money back. You know, I make that clear, too, because I intend at the end of the day to get my money back. Mm-hmm. It is true that, you know, once you give them their fee, it's a problem. We're going to take a little bit of different approach on the next case we're filing, which is a big case. I don't want to get into details about it, but when we do file, we'll share it with everybody about another way of accessing the court with a paper that makes it clear and gets rid of the statutory process and brings us into a non-statutory process. And it's going to be interesting to see how they respond. But we're coming in from a very unique perspective and a position. We've been holding court for over 2 years now, and I don't think they understand it, but we do have a court case open with a number. We did pay, and we objected to the payment. We want our money back. But nevertheless, we had to go through what we had to do to get into the system, to get into the court. And we on that papers that we had filed and put together, we did that for the sole purpose of having a place to be under the auspices of the court. In other words, we're reporting everything we're doing from the perspective of a grand jury, because we filed this case from the perspective of a grand jury. And so... So we filed it there, and we also filed it with the Justice Department, the Attorney General, what's his name before Barr? Remember his name? For some reason, I can't think of his name. But in any event, we filed it with him also, because we also filed indictments, and we sent it to them for execution. And so they were taking our papers. We had to indict the clerk, and we had to indict one judge. And we've still been filing papers, and they're still taking them. They know enough not to return them because that's a crime. We let them know that. So that's kind of a unique thing we're doing. But we've been in court for 2 years with these people, and they have acquiesced on everything. They have not, with the exception of the President of the United States. He's the only one that responded. He's the only one that's acting and doing the right thing. And we do know he's going to be shutting them down, the IRS anyway, at some point in time, the Federal Reserve. That's pretty clear. Anybody that's following along, he's throwing a lot of hints about what he's doing. So anyway, we will have something to do with that. But you can send them this. Well, look, I'm sending this under what would it be?
Duress.
Protest.
Yeah.
Under protest and duress. And duress. You can use that too, because now that becomes more of an injury to you. The next thing I would be doing is, again, you have to think about this, whether you want to do this or not. This is pretty bold. I've done it. But you got to be real careful to do it. And that is, I add that judge, make him a defendant, okay, mm-hmm. and for that sole purpose. So you could do that, but I don't suggest to do it unless you you really got to think this out, and you better know what you're doing if you're going to do something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I can resubmit it and then, put a copy of the letter.
You can go after them later, too. You make the point, and this is wrong, and you're responding because you have no other choice in order to get access into a court. And you see, what they've done is they have concealed courts of law. They've literally concealed them. There's no access to them. And I know of a couple of claims and something recently that I think there's someone in the room that's going to bring these issues up on this thing where a court of record is, but I have not found anyone to tell me the address of this court of record and show me any proof that it exists. I'd like to see the papers. Are they charging fees? And I'd like to see the papers that you would use, which would be called a cover sheet form, mm-hmm. Which states statutory fees on them. And statutory fees are fine when they're operating under the U.S. titles under certain jurisdictions, which, by the way, and we did a paper on this, and we did read it some months back on USC Title 18, where the jurisdiction, which is clearly in there, you can't deny it, their jurisdiction is admiralty or maritime law, So it's the law of the sea and not the law of the land, yet that's where you find the penal code, okay? Mm-hmm. The rules of the court are found under USC Title 28. You have the rules of the court. Rule 12, it's called, where they try to throw you out for not stating a claim. And it doesn't matter how well you put your paper together. It doesn't matter how much evidence you have. It doesn't matter how well you laid everything out and made things clear point by point by point by point. Failure to state a claim. And it's just nothing but abuse of the court, abuse of the process, and fraud. Nothing short of that. And you get two or three judges working together, like the federal case that we put in, we're probably going to go, we have a judge, which we've already indicted, and we have goodness, why can't I think of that name? Hang on a minute. Just take a quick look on the way. Can't think of it. Magistrate, okay? Mm-hmm. So they have both a magistrate and a judge on our case. Well, both of them are playing the same game and saying the same thing. That's conspiracy. They also want this money, and that's RICO. And we're going to make those points clear as we go forward because we want to finish dealing with that. And we'll continue to use that particular case in order to file all our papers, plus our new case, which, again, I don't want to get into details on how we're going to go about doing this, but it should be soon, and when we do it, we'll reveal it to everyone. And then people can maybe copy some of the things we're doing and see how they go. So again, you know, you can pay the fee, make a big stink about it, that you shouldn't be charged. There's a lot of stuff up there that you can find a lot of stuff on our site and papers that we've used, whereas, you know, they're not allowed to charge for justice.
Right. I mean, what they directed me to do is to file a pauper's affidavit, which obviously I don't want to do because they're They asked me to file a pauper's affidavit if I do not want to pay the fee. But in that affidavit you know what I'm saying? But then in that fee... in that document you have to list all your salary, all your money, your everything. I'm like, that's none of your business. I'm not giving you that information.
That's a game they play.
There you go.
Well, again, you know, I would look at some point in the future, you know, I'd press it through the way I told you to press it through. And the fact that judge ordered the removal of that paper out of that filing is a crime in itself. If it was prima facie, they can't remove it. It's against the law. And for a judge in conspiring with a clerk or someone like that, it's 20 years in jail for that judge and a hefty fine plus restitution. I wouldn't care. I couldn't care less. This fine business is a bunch of BS. But, you know, really, if there's any money in a court when someone is, let's say it's some kind of a crime against an individual, they need to be restored. The money, the jury needs to know to restore the individual that was injured in the crime. They'll use that person as a, you know, as the witness and the person who was injured and beat up or whatever the case may be, and then they'll go after the violator with a prison sentence, which makes them money. It's a whole RICO system there, and then of course there may be even fines. Again, makes them more money, and it just goes on and on and on. But yeah. Just protest it, pay it, move forward, make the point that this does not change my jurisdiction. I stand on my jurisdiction. This is a court of record, which proceeds according to natural law. I'm using the word natural law more often than common law because these lawyers are so dumb out there that they don't even understand what common law is.
Correct.
And pretty sad. And they think that common law is the usage of court decisions at trial level, no less. I mean, not just, you know, court decisions of a final decision by the United States Supreme Court or an appellate court, but the trial court decision. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth, you know.
Right,
so
right.
That's how I would go forward.
Okay.
And again, the judge later on.
Yeah, later, not right now, of course. Yeah, pick and choose your battles, that's how I figure.
Right.
Okay, I appreciate it, John. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, let's go to our next caller. It's Crystal. How you doing, Crystal? Let me hit the button. You got the mic, Crystal. How you doing? How's things going out there in Connecticut? Crystal Mack, you got the mic. You've been unmuted. Hello, Crystal. One more time for Crystal Mack. You got the mic. Okay, she must be away from her computer. Let me see if I can leave her in the queue and just mute her. We'll try again in a little while. Okay, I think I've got her muted. Let's go to our next person. Oh, we lost Crystal. She'll have to get back in the queue. Missouri Williams, you got the mic.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I was late coming into the call, and I was just wanting to see that I sent some question in on the. I received a collection notice from. DirecTV, so I don't know if they answer my questions that I sent in or not.
You received a notice from where?
There's a collection agency that's collecting for their, you know, for the party that was we supposed to be owed the debt to. DirecTV, sent us a note saying that we were behind in 2016 for the, you know, for the service that they did for us, gave us the, you know, the service in 2016 and 15. But since the foreclosure on the house and it was sold in 2015, we canceled the service. We told them that we didn't have a place to, you know, to so they have to cancel the service, but they coming back and saying that they're collecting, you know, what was left on the contract, which we didn't. I asked for the blue ink signature, but they didn't produce it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, look at send them a notice and demand, and lay it out the way Bill Thornton has taught us to do it, and we've got a form that we use. It's a notice and demand, and you can tweak it to your own needs. You can find that up on our website under, let's see, hang on a second. You go underneath due process, click due process, and then down the bottom page there's a link to get in there, which you can then download all of the forms for that and follow that procedure. You can also go out to Bill Thornton's website, which I think is 1215.org, if I recall, and you can get some information there. He's got a lot of good stuff out there, and he's got a nice plan layout of all, I think there's 8 points that must be met. I don't like the way it was written. I think we wrote it a lot better than the way he's got it. So between the two, you can really use those things to kind of formulate your own. But send them your notice and demand. Be very clear about things. Follow the procedure and the process of the notice and demand. Make sure you hit all your points and tell them that you want proof of claim. Now, okay, they're not going to even understand what a proof of claim is. They don't know nothing. They'll probably take it to a lawyer. The lawyer will say, don't worry about these clowns. Well, then you could default them, and now you're ready. You've got something to deal with these people because they may try to injure your credit at a later time. And you can say, you know, you can use this as a proof text, that proof that you've tried to settle this problem, but they didn't respond. They acquiesced. And, of course, at that point, you know, I know they'll try to injure your credit maybe without going to court or anything because they can't collect. The collection agency only sends letters out. They really can't do nothing but maybe put a report on. It's not probably not enough money for them to worthwhile to take you to court. But at this point, if they default, it may be worth your while to take them to court. And because you're going to lay out on the paper, you end up with just a show cause why a judgment shouldn't be taken against them for ABC, because you'll lay it out inside of a similar to a wherefore clause inside your notice and demand, which is this is what I'm going to do if you fail, and I'm going to take control of everything, and this is what I'm going to require. So at least that puts you in a protective mode. And should they injure your credit, you have the opportunity to take them into court. And hopefully you'll be able to get in without having to pay the fee. And if you have to pay the fee, you're going to have to go through what we discussed the last caller with. But you know, I think soon, when we file our papers, I don't think it's going to be long after, because of all that's going on in the world today, especially in this nation, and with the deep state and taking them down. And, you know, these judges are not going to have any place to hide anymore. They're not going to have the protection. Things are going to be very disruptive for them. So I think soon, you know, at some point, as long as we, the people, put our time and effort into it to take control, okay, that's what we must do. If we don't do it, then we won't have control. No one's going to give it to us. Even Trump doesn't even, I don't think he can give it to us or understand how to give it to us. He can only encourage people to go out and learn and do what you got to do, because the people have to take control of this. But in any event, that's what we're doing, and that's why we need as many people to work with us, behind us as possible, supporting us financially, supporting us maybe with some of your time, supporting us with being there when we need the people behind us to do whatever it is we're doing, which is, again, taking back the judiciary. So anyway, just prepare yourself and protect yourself by doing that. Now, remember, a proof of claim has to be a sworn affidavit. They can create one themselves, but they won't even know that. But if they don't send one, If they send something and it's not a and the proof of claim is not sworn to, don't even bother telling them. Just let the time go by and then let them know that they failed to send a proof of claim and you default them. And again, then when you go into court, it's really only a matter of going in for a show cause why judgment shouldn't be taken. We've already had this argument. We had this debate. These people didn't respond. And I defaulted them already. So tell me why judgment shouldn't be taken against you now. And they're not going to be able to do that. I'm sure they'll write some fancy stuff, but you should be able to beat it up pretty easily.
Okay. Thank you, John.
All right. You got it.
Okay.
Okay, let's take our next call. If anybody wants to get into the queue, we only got a couple of people in the queue, and it's still kind of, your night is still a little young yet, so star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue. Let's take Felicia in Florida. You got the mic.
Hello, Mr. John and everybody else. Hey. And Mr. A. Okay. I have a lot of questions, but, you know, I just want to say this. It's like when you guys talk, it triggers things in my brain. It'd be like, you know what? It's been in plain sight the whole time. But I have a few questions, but I don't want to waste too much time. But the one main question I want to ask is, you know, ever since Trump became the new president and he said he was going to drain the swamp, and, you know, we all know about Pizzagate and everything that's going on, and then,
Jeffrey Epstein is the pinnacle of that, and it's opening up as we speak.
I know.
And see huge things happen and with big names, and because that's how he's going to take them down. But go ahead.
And everybody's, you know, somebody just resigned from Trump office because he's affiliated with it or know him, and everybody's saying, oh, I know him. Over 15.
He's with the Department of Labor, that guy, and I think he's, I really kind of think from listening to what he had to say and listening to how much the president is supporting this guy and saying, look, he really doesn't have to resign. I didn't ask for his resignation, but he's given it to me. And his reason behind was that he doesn't want to upset the plan, and it's just going to put focus on him, and they're going to be relentless with it. So he resigned for that purpose. I do believe that he was between a rock and a hard place. He was a U.S. attorney at the time, I believe, and it was a state issue. It was, you know, it was a state crime and an issue. It was not a federal one, but he was involved somehow and was trying to get something done. But remember, there was a lot of people involved in that case. And really, you know, everything has been arranged that this guy was going to get off. I mean, goodness, he went to jail, and he only spent 8 hours a day in jail. He went to jail to sleep, and he was back out in the streets doing business and probably molesting more children and coming back at night to sleep. And so, and I think he's got 13 months. And of course, that was, you know, just horror. But the fix was in. I mean, he had the President Clinton with him. He had a lot of big-name people. And he was protected in status quo. So they all work what they can. And I don't think that he even as a U.S. attorney, could have done much to get anything more than what was gotten back then. So...
So how do you think that this would affect Trump's 2020?
Not at all. Look, I'll tell you what. I'm going to make a statement that is going to seem, you know, extreme or I don't know what I'd say. Well, I really think this. I think on the Democrat side, they have nobody. I mean, absolutely nobody.
Right.
And the numbers are there for Trump. I mean, look at everyone who voted for him before. They're going to vote for him again. And he has picked up a lot more people since then, not just on the Republican side, but the Democratic side. He may be the very first president ever to run for office and win in a landslide that he wins the electoral votes of every single state. That possibility in this election coming up is very, very possible. Also, you know, besides that, he definitely is a type of a Cyrus for anybody who's looked into that. And, you know, God was clear. I'm trying to remember where it was. I think it was, it might have been Isaiah. I think it was Isaiah. God was pretty clear that towards the end, he's going to judge nations. And that's what's happening right now, believe it or not. The nations are being judged. He's changing the world. And anybody following him is seeing the changes that this guy is making. He's making peace everywhere. He's doing business with everybody. He's killing the deep state every way he can. I mean, one of the biggest problems is Iran with the deep state over there. And that's why the Democrats are so protective of that situation. It's the, one of their last holdouts over there in the Middle East. And
Iran actually, they changed the name from Mesopotamia from the Bible to Iran, Iraq.
I don't know, to be honest. I really don't know. I'd have to go and look that up to see if that's true. But yeah, the names have changed over there, no doubt about that. But the point is, though, is that things are changing, and they're changing hugely. And it's not just in America; it's around the world, and people are supporting Trump in other countries. I mean, it's just amazing. So something big is going on and happening, and I think we're going to see landslides. It would not surprise me if he won every single electoral
vote. Look
at the people that are running against him at this point. I mean, it's ridiculous. He's going to shred any one of them. I mean, they can't even answer or respond. Look at that 25-year-old kid congresswoman from New York. I forget her name, but I don't need to remember it anyway. But look at the things that that are the debate or the exchange with that one of the Border Patrol guys who was a cop before, and he was working down on the border, and he just tore her to shreds, and she just had to move on. I mean, this is how bad people are. They're holding issues that are socialist issues. They're going to be destroyed, totally destroyed. I think it's going to be huge. But we'll see what happens. But things are moving to the benefit of the people. And okay. Judgment is coming upon the nations. That's what I see.
Okay, I have another question, but I'll get back in the queue. It may not get answered.
One more, if it's a short one, because we only got two other people in the queue.
Okay. From what my research that I have done with myself on 5G network, we just had, you know, I've watched here in Florida, Cape Canaveral launched a lot of rockets, and to see it with the naked eye is unbelievable. Just unbelievable to see it with the naked eye. It's not like what it looks like on television, I can tell you that. But the 5G network and the 5G cell phones, I personally think it's all tied into the chemtrails and the elf towers to population control.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at I'm you know, with the towers, that's a major, major problem, and maybe those will disappear. But again, you know, they use that for the cell towers at the same time, I guess, so I don't know. This 5G thing, I understand it's a real serious danger, but it's also a high technology, and in the hands of an out-of-control government, we could be in real big jeopardy. Now, should that mean that we shouldn't go forward with 5G, or should we? And again, in the hands of the wrong people, we have a problem. We may have an opportunity to be able to do some protection here, maybe we can do something through the courts as we move forward and get past where we have to get past, and maybe try to deal with that particular problem in the courts. Look, they're recording every single phone call, every single electronic, exchange of information, whether it's text or audio or whatever, video. They got everything. That's unlawful. No government should be collecting that kind of information. And now we have to shut them down. There's no doubt about it, but it's not number one on our list, that's for sure. We'll look at this thing with, what's it called, the 5G, I think? Is that what it's called? 5G? We'll have to look deeper into that. I don't have much knowledge of it, but we'll have to look deeper into that. I know Trump is big on that because it's going to change the way that we do business in a lot of things, the high-tech involvement here somehow. And again, I don't know how and what. But you know, look at a lot of things that are good for us and could really advance us in many ways could also be very dangerous to us, and they're already existing. So what we have to do is put the government in check. And again, I want to get back to it. The people don't step up and take control, get themselves educated, and step up and be counted when the time comes, and get involved in some way, even if it's just supporting us financially, but getting involved. If they don't do that, then we got a problem. But if they do that, and we do get things moving, and we do take control, and the people do get educated, and we do fill all the vacancies that we need to fill across this nation, which is about 15,000 administrators we need, paid positions, full-time career, and also at least bare minimum five people running for committeemen in every county, or at least in every state, but every county would be preferable, because it would be much more powerful and we'd be able to organize better and so on and so forth. And so if we can fill those positions, now we have 3,134 counties or something like that. So we're looking at about 5,000 committeemen nationwide. Now, if we could take those two positions with those numbers of people alone, okay, definitely take full control, and we can really press the issue and shut all these things down and set in, again, we look at the technology, we look what's available and why we want to go forward with it and how they might abuse it and what can we do to prevent that from ever happening. And again, as long as the people take control and keep control, we're good. The liberty of our nation must be in the hands of the people in the grassroots. It must be. And if they're not willing to take control of it, then we don't deserve it. And we're incapable of liberty then. And, you know, to be morally minded is a requirement here, too, you know. They have demoralized, and they've been spending, you know, my entire lifetime. I remember when this whole thing started, and maybe it started before my time, too, but, you know, but it came to surface and was no longer a secret by the time we got into the 70s or the 80s. And everything is just out there to destroy. But again, we can prevent all this if the people take control. Because we do not have government by consent at this point in time. And the reason we don't have government by consent at this point in time is because the people are not educated and knowledgeable enough to know how to take control of their government and have a government by consent, and or they're not willing to learn. So it gets back. If we don't get it, it's our fault at that point. Because we have great opportunity at this point in time. We have opportunities that have never been available to this nation before. Opportunities that can, you know, bring us to where we need to be and be total control and in a safe situation. So.
Yes, sir. I don't want to take up time. Thank you very much.
Right. Yeah, let me move on. If you want to get in, there's only two other people in the queue right now. You can get back in again. But yes, anybody else wants to get into the queue, star 6. We still have about 35 minutes, so star 6 to get into the queue. Okay, let's take our next caller. No name, but it's a 715 area code. You've been unmuted.
Yeah, okay. My name is Steve. I'm from Wisconsin.
Steve from Wisconsin.
I've talked with Jim a couple of times, and I'm the guy that's got three cases in the one challenging jurisdiction.
Uh-huh.
But Jim and I guess we decided to just go with my wife's case because that was the only one filed against us. But my question is, I haven't had any luck filing my own cases with these people. They find ways to get my cases dismissed and the thing is, my wife and I are victims of just the Wisconsin Department of Revenue right now. It's not the IRS or anything like that. It's the Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, look, we've got enough information on the website to educate you in order to do it yourself, but that's going to take time. And whether we assist you in a different way or not, you need to educate yourself anyway. So you should start an education. Get the government by consent course going. Work through that. We also have a civics course, which I, you know, take that secondary. We have a book on court access that's free. This is all for people who are prime members. And a prime member is someone who's a member of National Liberty Alliance and gives us $5 a month or more. And of course, if people really can't afford that $5, there are some people, you know, that are on such a tight budget that $5, they just can't do it. And so we'll give them free access because we want this knowledge to get out. We're not here to make money, but we do need money to move forward and do the things we do. So, but we'll give everyone access. We want everybody to get educated. Freely we have been given, so freely we're going to give out. But anyway, that's where you want to start to begin with. Now, if you want, you can also work with Jim, and we can take your case, and we can file for you. This is the process in order to get a joinder. You fill out a paper, give us some basic information. Jim prepares the joinder paper form for you, sends it back to you. Sign it and mail it to us. We ask for a donation of $100 or more. And again, that goes to pay the cost and help support us. But we will then file and work with you for the filings of what's called an amicus curiae. We will challenge jurisdiction for you as the grand jury coming in as a friend of the court, in this case a friend for the petitioner, which would be you. And we would move that forward to the point where we get, because they're not going to answer most likely, but they may cease and desist. It could happen automatically. It could just happen right away because they start to take us serious. But if not, then we will work with you to file an affidavit of default. And then the final paper that would go to them is moving their case to join it in a federal case here in New York on the Northern District is where we're doing our main filing. So we'll file your case with us and seek to move it forward and at bare minimum get you restored to your original state, so whatever money and cost. Plus, we'll look for restitution, and we will go after them for fraud on the court and conspiracy between the judges or judge and lawyers. You know, it only takes two people to get a conspiracy going, and when you have a lawyer and a judge working together to defraud you, you now have a conspiracy. And possibly RICO and some other things. We're not pushing. Well, we're hoping not to push anything in a way that's criminal, but when we start the indictments, then it becomes criminal because that's another move that we're going to be making is indictments against judges and those lawyers working with these judges to defraud the people. So that's what you could do there if you want. Jim can take you through the process. Anybody else that wants to attach their case to 2 hours with a joinder, you can send a request to intake@nationallibertyalliance.org. Okay?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to Cynthia. How you doing, Cynthia, up there in Massachusetts?
Oh, hi, John.
Massachusetts, right? You're in Massachusetts, right? Or is it Maine?
I'm a former resident. I'm not a resident anywhere at this point.
Okay.
But I was born in Massachusetts and, went through all of that stuff there. But I'm glad you brought up that Epstein case. I'm praying that it becomes an open door.
No doubt. That's the plan.
Yeah.
That's the plan.
Yes. Well, in 2011, you'll see how crazy this is, and I'll try to be concise as possible, but
Before you go into that, hang on a minute. Let me just give some people information here. you know, anybody that really wants to follow what's going on, and, you know, all our time is limited. Sometimes you can't listen to all the things that's going on, and you try to keep up, and you miss this or miss that. There are two places people can go at bare minimum and keep really up to date on everything that's happening. If you click on our tab that says Q on our blue bar there and go to that page on Q, you will find X22 report. And you should listen to X22 report and put them on, subscribe to them, and you'll get something every day from them. No, they usually
You find them credible?
Oh, the most. This is, I've been listening to this guy for, goodness, a year and a half now. He's right on the mark, very careful, absolutely credible. There's no doubt this guy is not just somebody just running some YouTube station. Okay. He's really given some good info.
Okay. Well,
but anyway,
yeah.
We've got a few others on this page that you can click into. And there are also some introduction stuff on, for instance, The Plan to Save the World by Q is here, and also The Long Road to the White House with Donald Trump is here. This is really good stuff. War, the full movie, Official Trump, and there's a few other things. So as time goes on, you can watch those videos. But you'll see X22 report, and if you take their report every day, now he does a report every day, somewhere between like 30 minutes to maybe 45, 50 minutes. Very rarely does he go to an hour. But in that 40 minutes, he's giving you everything that's really happening, all the main stuff, the meat of what's really going on. And he's really puts it together really well. The guy really does a good job at it. But and there's other if you want to listen to more. So that, at least listening to the X22 report, and also on the right-hand side of our website, we have a blue box that says Breaking News. And these are 2 to 4 minute clips of just breaking stories, gives you the highlights. And then, of course, if you want to more interested in that, you would take that information, run over to YouTube, run the keywords, and you can get more details on those stories. But at least between those two, you're going to really be kept up to date of what's going on and have everything you need to know. And you can go deeper if you want.
Well, yeah, because I think it's going to, you know, it's not a central issue. Like, for example, I just want to say I'm a master's level clinician, a lot of experience and everything, and has done extensive research. So in 2011, after I lost custody of my son and my situation got so bizarre, I can't even put it into words, but I filed a complaint with the Missing Children Exploitation Bureau. And it originally was missing, but it changed to exploitation. And then in June of that year, I got case numbers that went to
How old is your child now?
Oh, now he's 19. But this is what was when he was taken from me, like around 10, 11 years, about 10 years old. And so it had to do with child pornography, internet child pornography, and computer crime unit. So that's where these case numbers went to. So I ran around, you know, like a frantic mother. I probably looked crazy. And I was, you know, totally marginalized, discredited, called all kind of psychobabble diagnoses here and there. I mean, it's just been horrendous. Trying to get to protect my child from any kind of, you know, exploitation. So till this day, I really don't know. I wrote up a document. I sent it actually in this fake probate family court. I even submitted this, and they didn't want to hear it. I mean, they can't deal with it. Whatever this is very high level, and it's sick. So having said that, you know, I'm just praying that this opens the door for, you know, myself and other people across the country, you know, who have been, like, having to deal with this high-level systemic corruption. So so going back to the and I just ask everybody to pray about that because, you know, we're all trying to find justice and a sane remedy to this. And I'm coming in the spirit of peace and reconciliation. But in terms of enjoining cases, and I'm telling you, just please bear with me because my head is kind of swimming. So I'm just hoping you can just point me in the right direction what you think I should do. Because, and I think it's related to this, what I just talked to you about, how crazy my situation systemically became. So there was two family court cases. And it became two because that's how they were working off of two cases, you know, and I don't want to get into details, but one was family support, family separation, and another was divorce. The court refused to remove any motions from me, any requests to remove the divorce since I put it in, and they kept it in the books, and it worked, and, you know, so the court divorced us because that's, it worked out better for them and you know, the funds and how the funds were coming in. So for those two cases, it boiled down to one case that ended up in appeals. And last year, you know, became moot because my son turned 18 years old. So, you know, I was going to put it in anyway, in appeal. So I went through, I mean, basically, it was such a joke, all the laws that were violated, even the statutes that were violated. It was just it became like I felt insulted to even put all this more effort into it, having, you know, put hours and hours and hours into this thing. So now with this whole fake divorce situation, I want to do a jurisdiction, like, you're calling it challenge jurisdiction, correct?
Have you got contact with your son now?
I do. There's an estrangement. It's very,
Has he been abused by the families he's been with, or has he, you know, got a reasonably decent upbringing since you lost him? What's that status?
Barely. I think a lot of it's emotional. I really don't know the details, and I think because of the I didn't really want to, like, probe him because I didn't have the control to do anything about it. So I didn't want to really get in there. But when he this whole case got over with, I lost everything. I lost the house. I lost all my assets. I lost. That was the whole objective.
This is what you could do. You know, you can fill out a paperwork with us and join your case. We'll do an amicus curiae, challenge jurisdiction, demand for you to be restored back to your original state, which would be huge in your case because you've lost the son. And they're going to deny it or ignore it or do whatever they want to do with it. We then would send another paper with a notice of default and a demand for restitution. And again, they'll probably ignore it or deny it or whatever. And then we would move it after that process of time. It's 30 days to wait for the jurisdictional challenge and demand for restitution. And then it would be another maybe 5-7 days, maybe another week or so. To allow the time to go forward after you give the notice of default. Then after that, then we'd send another paper in, and all this would be done by the grand jury. We'd then send another paper in, joining your case onto ours, and with a wherefore clause to restore. But at the same time, a lot of this restitution would be applied for your son, too. I mean, he has lost his family. And that's the biggest destruction that they have caused. But the key thing to that is because you don't know his state or frame of mind and you would want to try to get a relationship back, this might assist and help, first of all, the winning a case. Does he understand what really happened? Does he know anything?
He knows. I mean, he has. I don't really want to get, you know, until...
Right. No,
okay, let me just say, like, when he turned, let's see, like 16, when this whole thing was over with, I think he was 15, And I you know, I lost permanent custody of my child. We were in the same town. And what happened, my son made his way back home, okay, because I was in the house fighting foreclosure at that point. And he came, you know, and he ended up staying with me for 2 years. And it got so bad, you know, he didn't want to go back to the father's apartment. And, you know, and so we did a lot of makeup, and that was a beautiful thing. So we did a lot of makeup. But then I lost the house, and I got this place, and now I'm not even in the state anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this estrangement happened.
Here's the key problem, though. Mm-hmm. We don't know his mental state per se as far as, and he may be fine mentally on the one end, but he may be dysfunctional with other things, and money could destroy him. So you'd want to be very careful on how you put things together as far as the money, because money's not going to solve the problem, number one. It's not going to change. You can't get back those child years, and you can't get those things back. So the only thing that can be given is money. I mean, that's it. But given someone that has gone through these kind of situations, money might be destructive. So you'd want to be careful on how you work and frame that part of it out.
He has goals and, you know, things like that. I mean, you know, it's one of those things, you know, you just, you know, at his age now, you know, you were 19 before. So, you know, you really want to get out in the world and do this and do that. And I remember, he might have blocked it out, but I remember a lot of things and I documented it, you know, and he knew I was fighting, you know. He lost his home, all kinds of things.
Here's the key thing, getting back to his mental state, okay? Here's mm-hmm. the key thing. You know, what kind of adolescence, proper adolescence did he go through? You know, we look at our children and they go through stages and they go through what's called adolescence, okay? When they become a teenager, then they're in their adolescence, which means they're really learning to be an adult. This is when you start to give them that extra freedom, but then there's penalties because you're monitoring them and, you know, if you can't be mature enough to handle this and I'm trying to work with you on this, I'm going to take it away from you. And so depending on how that part of his life went, which in most cases in these kinds of situations, not well, then you would want to control anything until he goes through his late years, adolescence, which means he may not be capable of handling money without destroying his life, maybe until he's late 20s or even 30s, who knows? Maybe never. And then you just would have to be this would have to be done in a trust. And I'm just throwing this out at you. If you went down this route, you do want to set things up that you don't do more destruction to him.
There are people who specialize in, you know, parental alienation and impact on children and, you know, so, you know, I totally get what you're saying, you know. But
I would choose from all the people involved, okay, and I'm sure you can get that list, and I'd add them all into this case, and you're looking to be restored. You know?
Yes, but please, these are the two. Okay, so out of that, I got these, like a criminal charge, okay, because I was trying to protect my son, and, you know, I realized this whole thing was a joke, so my son became a priority, and I actually mentioned that to the judge. You know, if I had to choose to obey your unlawful rules or protect my son, I'll have to protect my son. So needless to say, I got a criminal charge for violating their fraudulent protective order. And so we had a trial, whatever. I got found guilty. The whole thing was a joke. I won't get into it. So it got appealed. So went up to the appeal thing, and it got turned around. But then the whole thing was about to get retried again, and I was, like, coerced and threatened to the point I pled guilty because I couldn't take anymore. You don't know all these courts. I was running around like crazy, and I was being tortured. So now that, I want to challenge jurisdiction on that, too. So there's the criminal charge. Okay, so then there's foreclosure.
Absolutely. You can challenge jurisdiction.
So there's a lot of cases. That's what I'm trying to get at. So
Each one has to be dealt with on its own filing number. Okay. And and we don't need to know too much about the case per se, you know, except for, you know, really we need sort of a synopsis of what took place and what's going on. Clearly they didn't have jurisdiction, and it's never too late to challenge jurisdiction.
Okay.
Never.
So Yes, and so I'm wondering if there's challenge jurisdiction. Could I just declare that this is not the appropriate jurisdiction and then request damages? Or, do I have to go to them to have them decide or not? I'm telling them it's not. Huh?
What you're going to do is, if we do it for you, we do it through what's called the amicus curiae, which makes us a friend to the court, in this case, to the petitioner, of course. And basically, we'll do the paperwork for you. It's a standard form type paper. We already know what they're going to do. I mean, lawyers, bar attorneys and judges, people are crazy. This is 20 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever the case may be. They could think, do, and say anything they want because they don't understand common law. You know, since there are no statutes of limitation. And the United States Supreme Court has ruled on numerous occasions, that if they never had jurisdiction, everything is as if it never was, okay? It's just all falls apart. And you're back to one, and now you're looking at just one thing, damages. And there are criminal things that could take place here, too. And we may apply them depending on how much resistance they give. The resistance would be by the judge or judges and potentially the lawyers involved.
There's too many of them.
You have to decide what you want to do.
It's too many quote unquote criminals. It's a systemic thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know what to say about that. But you mentioned before to also petition on the state level first before joining.
If you challenge jurisdiction in a lower court, it's underneath the state, let's say you're in a county court, a town court, a village court, or someplace like that, and you challenge jurisdiction, they have to go to the next level up for a court of record to make a decision. It must be decided. If you're in a state court, that would move it over into the appellate process level, the appellate level. And basically what you're doing is you challenge jurisdiction. The judge cannot make that decision. He can't hear the case because he's already biased. He or she already believes they have jurisdiction. That's why they made these rulings. So they're biased. So forget about it. You can't make that decision. But the decision must be decided. Okay, it must be decided, and that must happen in a court of record, one above. And you're willing, of course, to allow and accept the summary judgment of that that decision. And they should do the right thing. Now, they're not going to. If they say, okay, you're challenging jurisdiction, fine. It's up to them to move it into the court of record for a decision. If they try to make the decision on their own, you have to object. Say, oh, you can't do that. First of all, they make a decision without hearing the case. And it says that the case must be decided, which means it must be heard. And hearing just your one side is not really hearing the case. And if he does only hear you one side, then they got a rule for you because they got a rule on what's before them, okay? And so it should go right, and it's what's right to be done, but they're not going to. But let's say they allowed that to happen. Okay, well, now you're going to go and you're going to collect all the lawyers, all of the judges involved in all the cases, whether it's appellate level, state level, whatever, and you're going to add them to the case, move it into federal court for cause, and go from there. And now, again, that's where we're handling those things in our case if people want to do it with us. People could do this on their own. We do have the forms up there for them to kind of work off of to create their own positions and paperwork. But you have to be somewhat educated. Don't think you're going to take a form, throw it in the court, and maybe take the next form and move it along and you're going to succeed. Because once they find out you don't know what you're doing, they're going to beat you up.
Right. So basically,
oh, we gotta
yeah,
on.
I know what you're
we're
saying. I know that. Okay. All right. So basically, try to give the state the grace to do the right thing before, you know.
Yeah, think about whatever you want to do, and if you want our assistance, we'll help you.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah. All right.
All right. So thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
Let's go to our next caller. It's a Pennsylvania caller, 570.
Yes, hello.
Yeah. What's your first name?
This is Drew from Lewiston County, Pennsylvania.
How you doing,
Drew?
I
talked to you before. Good, good. I talked to you about someone dealing with the Lewiston County Family Courts here. I talked to you about my wife leaving with my granddaughter.
Uh-huh.
I figured my ex of 35 years ago who had visitation of a granddaughter kind of coerced her to leave, and since then, you know, she's filed divorce, she's filed PFA. They didn't get the PFA because I used their own statutes, and I didn't do anything under their own statute. I've done nothing, so the judge said, okay, then we won't put the PFA, we'll just continue for 3 months. So that's how she pretty much got me into the protection from abuse, just in case you don't know what that is in PA.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to live under that until August. I need to know what to do to get rid of this PFA so I can try to reconcile with my wife here.
Yeah, well, it's difficult in your case because it's family against family, it sounds like, right? This is a government not really involved per se. Or are they? I mean, maybe CPS is involved or something.
Well, no, there is no. I've been to CPS, and they're not involved. I was trying to get them involved, but there's no.
Well, luckily you did, because they'd make matters worse. Okay, but it's your granddaughter. Where's your granddaughter? Who's your granddaughter with right now? Is she with mom, dad?
She's with my wife, but you know, children is his who placed her in our custody. 13 years
right,
ago.
So she's with your wife, and you and your wife, I guess, are separated or something?
Well, yeah, my ex is definitely a narcissist. She manipulated her right out of my house.
Okay, but
she's
grandma and your grandpa, and she's got granddaughter.
Yeah, she's got the granddaughter. She went
and saw. And this is a child of your daughter or your son or what?
It's of my daughter, yes.
Okay, and that your daughter is her daughter also biologically.
My daughter is no.
My wife is the
step grandmother of the. Like I said, my ex of 35 years ago.
She's not blood to the grandchild.
Right.
Okay, but so you have a natural right here above her. Where does mom? Mom stand and?
Mom's unable to take care of her, and the reason that mom couldn't have the child
and what
is
about
because,
that?
What is that?
What about dad? Where's he at?
No, he's not in the picture.
Not at all. All right. Well, you have an op. How old is your granddaughter?
My granddaughter's 13. Like I said, the mother couldn't take care of her. Children Youth called us one day and said, "Well, if you can't take this child, we're going to give her to a foster care because she couldn't go with the grandmother because the hospital." Observed emotional abuse there, and that's how they got involved. So now my wife and my wife and granddaughter is now being controlled by this emotionally abusive person who was my ex of 35 years ago that I can't get out of my life. And she's, you know, puppeting her, pulling the strings. Her name is on the PFA. She's the one texting me every time something
happens. I don't want to get too many details because I don't really need a lot. We're just looking at as much of the natural law positions as possible here. But let me ask you, how is it that she ended up with your ex instead of you? How did that happen?
Well, my wife and I had custody of her. My wife is the step-grandmother. She's not her real grandmother,
right.
But we've taken care of her for 13 years. Apparently
okay,
in Pennsylvania.
Well, hold on. I need to get pictures here as you're going, so I have to stop you and ask other questions. Okay, so the child's been with you for 13 years to begin with, so you probably got her when she was a baby.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've raised them together for 13 years, you and your ex. Now you separated, and she took the child with her.
Let me clarify. I was with a woman when I was 16 years old. I had a kid. She took off with the kid. That's my daughter. Okay, then she comes back in my life when she's a teenager. She has a kid with some guy, and then me and my wife at this time got custody of her. So my ex, when I was 16 years old, just forced my wife and granddaughter out of the house. She did have visitation with the granddaughter. So now I'm in a situation where I went the other day to file, because everybody's like, well, why aren't you filing for custody? Why aren't you filing for custody to get back into custody? Because you did. I haven't seen my granddaughter since April. Well, I went there, and I filed everything, and I had a stamped up repositories. I had everything done. I was ready to mail it. I talked to a lawyer, and the lawyer says, you know, if you mail that, you're going to violate the PSA. I said, are you kidding me?
If you mail it what?
If I mail out the paperwork to go to a custody hearing to try to get my, you know, get my granddaughter back and all, then I'd be violating the protection from abuse order. So how is that possible? I don't know. So I didn't mail them.
Right.
And I have a PSA here.
There's a protection on your daughter against you. On your granddaughter.
No, my wife got the PSA. Now, I asked the PSA office.
So there's a protection. Your ex-wife filed the order of protection.
No, my wife.
Your ex-wife or your wife?
My wife. We're not divorced yet. We're proceeding divorce.
Okay, but you're separated.
Yeah, she's somewhere else now.
Okay. Where does the granddaughter want to be?
Well, right now, like I said, I don't know if anybody understands what narcissistic abuse is, but she's done this with my daughter. They know how to alienate. She's alienating. I feel as though they're victims right now. I feel like
I would not take this into any kind of a family court or anything. I take this into a court of law, open up a court of law, and do the best
I
can.
Well, I wanted to file suit against her, right? But how do I even do that with the PFA since I can't mail her any letters? I don't understand that. I can't serve her with papers and mail her letters or violates the PFA.
That's kind of ridiculous. That's a good question. I don't know. If Brent is here, maybe he can
respond.
Well,
it says on the PFA that I can't contact third party. I can't have anybody contact on my behalf, and I can't do social media. And I've done nothing for this.
Hang on a second. Hang on. Brent, are you here? Are you hearing this?
Sir.
You have any? Yeah, let me see if Brent is here. Brent. He may be away from his phone now.
John,
he's here.
Yes, I'm here,
okay.
John.
I don't know if you've been listening to this story, but you know, in the case of him filing a case against his wife, we'll call her the ex because they're separated, and there's an order of protection she took out against him, and some lawyer's telling him he can't sue her because that would be violating the order of protection by mailing her something. You got anything to offer on that?
Well, it's pretty touchy. I'm involved in a case like that now. And it's similar, as we say. It's not exactly the same. But I haven't found anything that delineates exactly. I'll tell you what, if you do sue in a situation like that, or you file papers against somebody that you've been ordered to stay away from or not communicate with, the danger to it would be that the judge would look at your papers and say that's frivolous. That's frivolous, and because it's frivolous, you're harassing that person. Therefore, then you're in violation of the protective order. But now, the safe thing to do, if you really thought you had a case, if you could find a this isn't required, but if you had a lawyer who would take it, that would put something between you and the person you're supposedly harassing. And the lawyer then would help you decide or help you craft it or help you say, well, now, be careful because it's possible he'd say this is frivolous. You're harassing. See, that'd be the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible.
Right.
I'm just saying,
John,
it's dangerous. Go ahead.
Yeah, John.
Yeah.
John, as well, when I was in the PFA court, the judge, like I said, didn't put the PFA on me, but she continued it for 3 months, so I'm still under the temporary order. And I think she had a bias because, you know, even though my wife did take care of the granddaughter for 13 years, it wasn't her child. I understand that. I mean, I'm grateful for that. But, you know, this judge comes up, she comes up, and she said, well, you took care of her for this long. She said, so you're her mother. We never taught her, never brought her up to be that. You know what I mean? We always, she knows who her mother is. So we always brought her up
that
that's her mother. We're her grandparent. You know, I don't know who
said that she's her mother, the judge?
The judge. The judge said, well, then you're her mother. Then that would mean I'm her father. But we didn't raise her that way. That's not our belief.
Yeah. Well, and that's biased also because...
That is a bias, yes. And I got the court transcripts for that, and it says it right
so
on.
So he's not a reasonable guy where you can go talk to the judge and explain the situation.
Yeah, it's a woman. It's a woman, and no, she's not being reasonable. Oh,
okay. That could be a bigger problem, yeah.
Well, the other thing is I did have an appointment with an attorney this week because I did think about getting an attorney to, as an intermediary, to serve the papers or whatever we, you know, file.
Yeah,
It's not frivolous. It's not frivolous, John. I know what he was saying, but it's not frivolous because it's...
Yeah, I understand that.
Even the judge asked me why I don't file. Even the judge said to me why I didn't file for the custody. Well, because I have a PFA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the only way I'm going to start this custody and see my granddaughter back is
Hold on. Look. You got a good case here because you're the biological grandparent, okay?
Right.
So that supersedes a lot of stuff in natural law, it does anyway.
Yeah.
I would, if I were you, I'd try to find a lawyer who will allow you to work with that lawyer in the case because lawyers take over a case and you really don't have much control. They do all the paper writing and most people don't want to get involved. They don't know nothing. Let the lawyer handle it, you know, whatever. I mean, look, when you're getting into a true court of record, a true common law court, you want to be involved yourself because no one knows what's really going on better and the facts better than you to begin with.
Right.
And that's another problem because – you see, when you file the papers, and this is the tough part, you know, you file the papers with a lawyer, and it's going to be an equity court. No matter what they do, it's going to be an equity court, maybe a quasi de facto equity court. I mean, you can throw a whole bunch of words in here, because it brings you right back to a statutory process.
Right.
And that is the big problem. This is the huge problem. And lawyers generally don't understand common law at all. And, of course, they have they already conceal the courts of record, and they put statutory papers up there in order to file for your cover sheet form to get into the court. And everything is set up with statutory fees and all this other stuff. And so the whole stage is set to bring you into a jurisdiction unknown, because it's
John, a mixed thing.
So it's a tough thing.
Can I say something here? Because you're familiar with what is the FCLU, the family law thing, that group, that organization. I think I heard you mention it sometime.
Who is it?
It's called the FCLU or something, like a family organization.
Yeah, I'm not aware of it, no. Maybe
okay,
Gerard.
Well, I was talking to them. You pay $90, you join with them, and then you go online and you kind of kick stuff back and forth with people on there. Now, they did just post something in my email that I seen, and it was talking about jurisdiction. And he was posting this big long thing about jurisdiction and courts and all that. One thing is he did mention Pennsylvania. He said, but Pennsylvania does have full jurisdiction in family court. So how is that? I'm not sure. Now, one other thing is...
Say that again. What's his full jurisdiction? Say that.
Yeah, he was saying something about Pennsylvania having does have total jurisdiction over family courts.
Okay.
Now, who says this?
A judge? A lawyer?
No, this is in my email from this organization.
Yeah. Well, that's what he believes. It doesn't make it true.
Right. Here, I could tell you some of it now if you want to.
This is extremely important. Any court that proceeds by statutory process is not a court of record. And if you challenge that because it's not a court of record and you're expecting to get into the jurisdiction of natural law in a natural law court, then clearly, constitutional-wise, natural law-wise, they don't have jurisdiction. No matter what you do and what they just don't have it. Now, go try to get a bar attorney that has no knowledge of common law, of natural law and the court systems and the way it really should be, and, you know, you're talking to someone who doesn't even understand your language. They're never going to go there. After all, they've got their education. They've got their degree. They've got their shingle up here. You're a dummy. I know what I'm talking about. You're just talking out of your rear end, and you don't know
what you're talking
about.
That's the way they're taught.
Sure. That's going to be their attitude. I spent a lot of money for this, and I got the single. It's unfortunate that they think that. But, you know,
thing,
but look
here's,
at
Here's the thing about a quarter record. I had called them and I told them I wanted the transcripts, and I filed the paper for the transcripts for the hearings for when they went in there. I wanted to see what they're saying about me and how the court could have the authority to try to keep my granddaughter from me. Something had to be said. So I want the transcripts. And then I called them and they said, oh, well, you can't get any. What was that?
You don't even have visitation with her?
I don't even have visitation. No, they just walked out the door with her, and I haven't seen her since. And the one judge took custody, and then the other judge with the PSA. And they don't want to hear what I said. I went back to file, and I couldn't file a custody.
Well, look, I don't really have a good answer for you at this point. I mean, education is the beginning of what my answer would be to you. So I would say no matter what you're going to do, and even if you don't know what you're going to do, start get educating. And so that's where you begin with. The other thing is, and I'll think about this, and maybe next week or the week after you come back and maybe ask again, and maybe I'll have some thoughts or ideas to send to you. But right now I don't have any more to offer than I have offered,
right,
which is really a lot of questions. And,
John, does the court have to give me records, those transcripts? Because I called for the transcript, and they said, oh, well, if there's anything recorded or in closed chambers, we can't give that to you. I said, what do you mean? I said, if it's anything said about me or any evidence against me, I need to defend myself against that because I've done nothing. They need
right
to tell me evidence against me.
Well, anything that's on the record you can get. You know, when they deal with children and stuff, they do keep things off the record, whether that's good or bad, that's debatable, and whether that's lawful or not, again, it's debatable.
Here's the problem. I've done absolutely nothing, and that's why I didn't, you know, give into the PFA thing. So I believe my ex may be getting my granddaughter to say something or pressuring her to say something, but why can't I get that record? I want the record because it's been illegal lawsuit.
Well, you can just go down to the clerk, and you could pull any case you want and print everything off that you get everything that's in the record. And if there's any, you know, recorded transcripts, you can ask for them, get a copy of that, get all that stuff. Now, if there's certain things that's in a closed, I don't know that you're going to be able to get it without trying to make an argument in a position to the court, which may require you to open a case. I'd have to think some of this out a little bit more, and I don't know that I really have an answer for you.
Is there
when
something
it comes
like
to
a file? Is there something like a file
to
get those records?
Hold on. When it's coming to the people who are arguing family inside of family, both sides, one side is family, the other side is family, you know, that's a whole different thing than what we're doing. We're dealing with mostly criminal things and things where people are stealing properties, you know, mortgage companies, the tax man.
They did steal my property. They stole my life. They stole my marriage, and it's financially hurt my business, and I'm looking at a lawsuit.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, you know, but again, you're going up against your wife that has custody and is claiming to continue with custody, and so that's family to you. It's family against family, so it's a little difficult for me to
get. I'm not trying to go against my wife and my granddad. I'm trying to go against my ex in the court. Just the court.
In my opinion, there's only one real good solution, and it's going to take time. And you can accomplish this in let's say 6 months to really if you put good effort into it, maybe even less, but you know, put really good effort into it to understand things, get educated, which you can get this education on our site. And of course, you know, you can go to Brent, and Brent has open forums and a program going also, I think he said, on Saturday mornings. And
okay.
You can go there and learn, and you can ask questions. I'm sure. And as time goes on, maybe we'll have more information. Right now, I don't have anything to add other than
right.
what I've told you.
All right, I do appreciate your time.
Okay. And look at, so, you know, if you look around, you know, maybe there's a lawyer out there advertising that they're a common law lawyer. And I would talk to that person to see once who they really are, if they really are, they understand what that is. And that, you know, that possibility is there. So
yeah, I have looked
at
that. But John, what do you think about attorney coaching, lawyer legal coaching?
I'm sorry.
It's legal coaching. It's a new thing a lot of attorneys are doing now. What they're doing is they're charging. They'll give like an hour, 2 hours, whatever time, going over a case with somebody, sometimes they'll review papers, sometimes they'll review
If they don't understand the jurisdiction you're getting into, it doesn't really be helpful because you're still coming in their process, the statutory
That's
process.
True. That's true.
So that's a problem. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with getting counsel, because, as a matter of fact, you know, in criminal cases, that's what we're guaranteed by the Constitution is counsel, not an attorney, not a lawyer. It could be an attorney. It's your choice where you get your counseling from. But that's the key point. Okay,
right.
It's your decision on which you get counseling. And now, of course, in their systems and in their courts, because they're operating under statutory processes, therefore that equity, they're in an equity court, and they make the decision whether they're going to put a statutory jury up there or not, ultimately, or they'll make some, summary judgment decisions. And again, so you're back. You're in a court that is operating under equity. You need to get out of that. That's the problem, and that's a very difficult thing to do.
So I should file suit and seek damages for marital interference and custodial interference, and look for remedy and recourse. Correct.
I would go and challenge the jurisdiction of the court that made those decisions, and you don't even have to go after her. You go after the court, and then you move it into a federal court for cause, and you go after that judge. And you're not only looking for restitution, you're looking for this whole case to be overturned and you receive back your daughter, your granddaughter.
Yes.
So that's another way to approach this, and that's the way I think you might want to go.
All right.
I challenge
jurisdiction for the PFA or for the, or what?
Well, I would challenge jurisdiction for everything.
I got to get rid of that first. I really do.
Listen to me, okay? You don't have to even bring your wife into this thing. You're going after the judge, okay? And the lawyer. Remember, you want to look for the conspiracy. It makes a stronger case. And if she's got a lawyer, so you go after the lawyer and you go after the judge. You're not going after her. And you're going after them, challenging jurisdiction. They don't have it, number one. And any decision that court made, you cease and desist and return you back to your natural state and give me my granddaughter back, because I am the blood.
Right.
Not her.
Okay.
That's what you think. No, think
so
about
there's
that.
So there's no timeline. I mean, I can go at any time and do this, because the hearing for the PFA and the other hearing was like a month and a half ago.
Listen. You could do this whenever you want. You're right. But
I'm going to file it right away.
You have to start getting educated. And so that you want to work through that process right away and get educated in how things work. And start thinking about this, and maybe next week, if you come up with more thoughts, ideas, questions, maybe I'll have more to add to this. But that's a good way to go. That's a good strategy, and you're not in a situation you're putting yourself in jeopardy by sending something to her in the mail.
I think that's good advice, John. That's what I'm going to do. I spend the week checking it out. I have studied for years already on this, but I'm going to talk to you next week. Maybe we can come together with something.
Yeah. We can give you some thoughts and ideas anytime. And even as you go through the process, but we don't need a lot of detail. You know, we're just looking for the legal angle. Okay. So, okay.
Right.
With that, we're going to end things.
Right.
So, Lord will. Thank you. Okay. We're going to end things.
Can you hear me? I was just going to say real quick, when it comes to filing that, in that case where she's got somebody's got a restraining order, it might be a good idea to file a motion with the court, and that would force the court to rule. And the motion would say something like motion for leave to file the papers or serve papers or file a case. I don't know what the case is. I didn't understand that. But if you file for a motion for leave to file and serve, then the judge would have to say one way or the other. And once he does, you're protected. Back to you.
Well, that's an interesting point, too, if you want to go that direction. That is another way to go. So, all right, well, that person could make a decision, got some time to think about it. I think we gave him a couple of good ideas that are really possible and protects him. So we'll see what he wants to do, and we could talk again next week or the week after. Appreciate it, Brent. Thank you. Okay, with that, we're going to end things. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday, and hopefully we'll all return, and we'll continue in these things. I'm not sure what the subject matter will be, but I am going to continue in keeping it down around 20 minutes, you know, whatever subject we take on. I might do a second thing, and I'm really feeling strong about this, on the tax court and the IRS. I might do something on the way they approach people and under what authorities they claim or think they have and what the truth is about those authorities. That I think is critical, because I did write a case concerning that, and matter of fact, it's still in the courts right now. It's, they don't want to answer. They're doing everything they can to prevent themselves from answer, but I'm hoping that things will go well where they're going to have to answer, and they're done. They can't answer what I put together for them. So maybe we can share that and talk about that issue there. But I don't know. I haven't made a decision on the topic yet, but I will, and I have a feeling it will be that. But okay, with that, good night, everyone. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Thanks for coming. Goodbye.